Hung Lu Meng, or The Dream of the Red Chamber, a Chinese novel, Book I. Chapter 1. Chen Qiyan, in a vision, apprehends perception and spirituality. Chia Yutsun, in the windy and dusty world, cherishes fond thoughts of a beautiful maiden. This is the opening section, this the first chapter. Subsequent to the visions of a dream which he had, on some previous occasion, experienced, the writer personally relates, he designedly concealed the true circumstances, and barred the attributes of perception and spirituality to relate this story of the Record of the Stone. With this purpose, he made use of such designations as Chen Qiyan, Truth Under the Garb of Fiction, and the like. What are, however, the events recorded in this work? Who are the dramatis personae? Wearied with the drudgery experienced of late in the world, the author, speaking for himself, goes on to explain, with the lack of success which attended every single concern, I suddenly bethought myself of the womankind of past ages. Passing one by one under a minute scrutiny, I felt that in action and in lore, one and all were far above me, that in spite of the majesty of my manliness, I could not, in point of fact, compare with these characters of the gentle sex. And my shame forsooth then knew no bounds, while regret, on the other hand, was of no avail, as there was not even a remote possibility of a day of remedy. On this very day it was that I became desirous to compile, in a connected form, for publication throughout the world, with a view to universal information, how that I bear inexorable and manifold retribution, inasmuch as what time, by the sustenance of the benevolence of heaven, and the virtue of my ancestors, my apparel was rich and fine, and as what days my fare were savory and sumptuous, I disregarded the bounty of education and nurture of father and mother, and paid no heed to the virtue of precept and injunction of teachers and friends, with the result that I incurred the punishment of failure recently in the least trifle, and the reckless waste of half my lifetime. There have been meanwhile, generation after generation, those in the inner chambers, the whole mass of whom could not, on any account, be, through my influence, allowed to fall into extinction, in order that I, unfilial as I have been, may have the means to screen my own shortcomings. Hence it is that the thatched shed, with bamboo mat windows, the bed of tow and the stove of brick, which are at present my share, are not sufficient to deter me from carrying out the fixed purpose of my mind. And could I, furthermore, confront the morning breeze, the evening moon, the willows by the steps and the flowers in the courtyard, methinks these would moisten to a greater degree my mortal pen with ink, but though I lack culture and erudition, what harm is there, however, in employing fiction and unrecondite language to give utterance to the merits of these characters? And were I also able to induce the inmates of the inner chamber to understand and diffuse them, could I besides break the weariness of even so much as a single moment, or can I open the eyes of my contemporaries, will it not forsooth prove a boon? This consideration has led to the usage of such names as Chia Yutsun and other similar appellations. More than any in these pages have been employed such words as dreams and visions, but these dreams constitute the main argument of this work, and combine, furthermore, the design of giving a word of warning to my readers. Reader, can you suggest whence the story begins? The narration may border on the limits of incoherency and triviality, but it possesses considerable zest. But to begin. The Empress Nuwo, the goddess of works, in fashioning blocks of stones, for the repair of the heavens, prepared, at the Tahuang Hills and Wuchi Cave, 36,501 blocks of rough stone, each 12 chang in height, and 24 chang square. Of these stones, the Empress Wu only used 36,500, so that one single block remained over and above, without being turned to any account. This was cast down the Qingkang Peak. This stone, strange to say, after having undergone a process of refinement, attained a nature of efficiency, and could, by its innate powers, set itself into motion and was able to expand and to contract. When it became aware that the whole number of blocks had been made use of to repair the heavens, that it alone had been destitute of the necessary properties and had been unfit to attain selection, it forthwith felt within itself vexation and shame, and day and night, it gave way to anguish and sorrow. One day, while it lamented its lot, it suddenly caught sight, at a great distance, of a Buddhist bonze and of a Taoist priest coming towards that direction. Their appearance was uncommon, their easy manner remarkable. When they drew near this Qingkang Peak, they sat on the ground to rest, and began to converse. But on noticing the block newly polished and brilliantly clear, which had moreover contracted in dimensions, and become no larger than the pendant of a fan, they were greatly filled with admiration. The Buddhist priest picked it up, and laid it in the palm of his hand. "Your appearance," he said laughingly, "may well declare you to be a supernatural object, but as you lack any inherent quality, it is necessary to inscribe a few characters on you, so that everyone who shall see you may at once recognize you to be a remarkable thing. And subsequently, when you will be taken into a country where honor and affluence will reign, into a family cultured in mind and of official status, in a land where flowers and trees shall flourish with luxuriance, in a town of refinement, renown and glory, when you once will have been there. The stone listened with intense delight. What characters, may I ask, it consequently inquired, will you inscribe? And what place will I be taken to? Pray, pray explain to me in lucid terms. You mustn't be inquisitive, the bonze replied, with a smile, in days to come you'll certainly understand everything. Having concluded these words, he forthwith put the stone in his sleeve, and proceeded leisurely on his journey, in company with the Taoist priest. Whither, however, he took the stone, is not divulged. Nor can it be known how many centuries and ages elapsed, before a Taoist priest, Kung Kung by name, passed, during his researches after the eternal reason and his quest after immortality, by these Ta Huang Hills, Wu Chi Cave and Ching Kang Peak. Suddenly perceiving a large block of stone, on the surface of which the traces of characters giving, in a connected form, the various incidents of its fate, could be clearly deciphered, Kung Kung examined them from first to last. They, in fact, explained how that this block of worthless stone had originally been devoid of the properties essential for the repairs to the heavens, how it would be transmuted into human form and introduced by Mong Mong the High Lord, and Miao Miao, the Divine, into the world of mortals, and how it would be led over the other bank, across the Sansara. On the surface, the record of the spot where it would fall, the place of its birth, as well as various family trifles and trivial love affairs of young ladies, verses, odes, speeches and enigmas was still complete, but the name of the dynasty and the year of the reign were obliterated, and could not be ascertained. On the obverse, were also the following enigmatical verses. Lacking in virtues meet the azure skies to mend, in vain the mortal world full many a year I wend, of a former and after life these facts that be, who will for a tradition strange record for me? Kung Kung, the Taoist, having pondered over these lines for a while, became aware that this stone had a history of some kind. Brother Stone, he forthwith said, addressing the stone, the concerns of past days recorded on you possess, according to your own account, a considerable amount of interest, and have been for this reason inscribed, with the intent of soliciting generations to hand them down as remarkable occurrences. But in my own opinion, they lack, in the first place, any data by means of which to establish the name of the emperor and the year of his reign, and, in the second place, these constitute no record of any excellent policy, adopted by any high worthies or high loyal statesmen, in the government of the state, or in the rule of public morals. The contents simply treat of a certain number of maidens, of exceptional character, either of their love affairs or infatuations, or of their small deserts or insignificant talents, and were I to transcribe the whole collection of them, they would, nevertheless, not be estimated as a book of any exceptional worth. Sir Priest, the stone replied with assurance, why are you so excessively dull? The dynasties recorded in the rustic histories, which have been written from age to age, have, I am fain to think, invariably assumed, under false pretenses, the mere nomenclature of the Han and Tang dynasties. They differ from the events inscribed on my block, which do not borrow this customary practice, but, being based on my own experiences and natural feelings, present, on the contrary, a novel and unique character. Besides, in the pages of these rustic histories, either the aspersions upon sovereigns and statesmen, or the strictures upon individuals, their wives, and their daughters, or the deeds of licentiousness and violence are too numerous to be computed. Indeed, there is one more kind of loose literature, the wantonness and pollution in which work most easy havoc upon youth. As regards the works, in which the characters of scholars and beauties is delineated, their allusions are again repeatedly of Wenchun, their theme in every page of Zuchen, a thousand volumes present no diversity, and a thousand characters are but a counterpart of each other. What is more, these works, throughout all their pages, cannot help bordering on extreme license. The authors, however, had no other object in view than to give utterance to a few sentimental odes and elegant ballads of their own, and for this reason they have fictitiously invented the names and surnames of both men and women, and necessarily introduced, in addition, some low characters, who should, like a buffoon in a play, create some excitement in the plot. Still more loathsome is a kind of pedantic and profligate literature, perfectly devoid of all natural sentiment, full of self-contradictions, and, in fact, the contrast to those maidens in my work, whom I have, during half my lifetime, seen with my own eyes and heard with my own ears. And though I will not presume to estimate them as superior to the heroes and heroines in the works of former ages, yet the perusal of the motives and issues of their experiences may likewise afford matter sufficient to banish dullness, and to break the spell of melancholy. As regards the several stanzas of doggerel verse, they may too evoke such laughter as to compel the reader to blurt out the rice, and to spurt out the wine. In these pages, the scenes depicting the anguish of separation, the bliss of reunion, and the fortunes of prosperity and of adversity are all, in every detail, true to human nature, and I have not taken upon myself to make the slightest addition, or alteration, which might lead to the perversion of the truth. My only object has been that men may, after a drinking bout, or after they wake from sleep or when in need of relaxation from the pressure of business, take up this light literature, and not only expunge the traces of antiquated books, and obtain a new kind of distraction, but that they may also lay by a long life as well as energy and strength, for it bears no point of similarity to those works, whose designs are false, whose course is immoral. Now, Sir Priest, what are your views on the subject? Kung Kung, having pondered for a while over the words, to which he had listened intently, reperused, throughout, this record of the stone, and finding that the general purport consisted of naught else than a treatise on love, and likewise of an accurate transcription of facts, without the least taint of profligacy injurious to the times, he thereupon copied the contents, from beginning to end, to the intent of charging the world to hand them down as a strange story. Hence it was that Kung Kung, the Taoist, in consequence of his perception, in his state of abstraction, of passion, the generation, from this passion, of voluptuousness, the transmission of this voluptuousness into passion, and the apprehension, by means of passion, of its unreality, forthwith altered his name for that of Ching Tseng, the voluptuous bonds, and changed the title of the memoir of a stone, Shitochi, for that of Ching Tseng Lu, the record of the voluptuous bonds, while Kung Mei Chi of Tung Lu gave it the name of Fen Yue Pao Chen, the precious mirror of voluptuousness. In later years, owing to the devotion by Cao Shi Chen in the Tao Hung study, of 10 years to the perusal and revision of the work, the additions and modifications effected by him 5 times, the affix of an index and the division into periods and chapters, the book was again entitled Qinling Xie Chai, The 12 Maidens of Qinling. A stanza was furthermore composed for the purpose. This then, and no other, is the origin of the record of the stone. The poet says appositely, dash. Pages full of silly litter, tears a handful sour and bitter, all a fool the author hold, but there's zest who can unfold? You have now understood the causes which brought about the record of the stone, but as you are not, as yet, aware what characters are depicted, and what circumstances are related on the surface of the block, reader, please lend an ear to the narrative on the stone, which runs as follows, dash. In old days, the land in the southeast lay low. In this southeast part of the world, was situated a walled town, Kusu by name. Within the walls a locality, called the Changmen, was more than all others throughout the mortal world, the center, which held the second, if not the first place for fashion and life. Beyond this Changmen was a street called Qi Li Chie, Ten Li Street, in this street a lane, the Jencheng Lane, humanity and purity, and in this lane stood an old temple, which on account of its diminutive dimensions, was called, by general consent, the Gourd Temple. Next door to this temple lived the family of a district official, Chen by surname, Fei by name, and Shi Yin by style. His wife, Nei Feng, possessed a worthy and virtuous disposition, and had a clear perception of moral propriety and good conduct. This family, though not in actual possession of excessive affluence and honors, was, nevertheless, in their district, conceded to be a clan of well-to-do standing. As this Chen Shi Yin was of a contented and unambitious frame of mind, and entertained no hankering after any official distinction, but day after day of his life took delight in gazing at flowers, planting bamboos, sipping his wine and conning poetical works, he was in fact, in the indulgence of these pursuits, as happy as a supernatural being. One thing alone marred his happiness. He had lived over half a century and had, as yet, no male offspring around his knees. He had one only child, a daughter, whose infant name was Ying Lin. She was just 3 years of age. On a long summer day, on which the heat had been intense, Shi Yin sat leisurely in his library. Feeling his hand tired, he dropped the book he held, leant his head on a teapoy, and fell asleep. Of a sudden, while in this state of unconsciousness, it seemed as if he had betaken himself on foot to some spot or other whither he could not discriminate. Unexpectedly he espied, in the opposite direction, 2 priests coming towards him, the one a Buddhist, the other a Taoist. As they advanced they kept up a conversation in which they were engaged. Whither do you purpose taking the object you have brought away? He heard the Taoist inquire. To this question the Buddhist replied with a smile, "Set your mind at ease," he said, "there's now in maturity a plot of a general character involving mundane pleasures, which will presently come to a denouement. The whole number of the votaries of voluptuousness have, as yet, not been quickened or entered the world, and I mean to avail myself of this occasion to introduce this object among their number, so as to give it a chance to go through the span of human existence. The votaries of voluptuousness of these days will naturally have again to endure the ills of life during their course through the mortal world," the Taoist remarked, "but when, I wonder, will they spring into existence? And in what place will they descend?" The account of these circumstances, the Bonze ventured to reply, is enough to make you laugh. They amount to this: there existed in the west, on the bank of the Ling, spiritual, river, by the side of the Sanchong, thrice born, stone, a blade of the Qianchu, purple pearl, grass. At about the same time it was that the block of stone was, consequent upon its rejection by the goddess of works, also left to ramble and wander to its own gratification, and to roam about at pleasure to every and any place. One day it came within the precincts of the Qinghuan, monitory vision, fairy, and this fairy, cognizant of the fact that this stone had a history, detained it, therefore, to reside at the Qisha, purple clouds, palace, and apportioned to it the duties of attendant on Shen Ying, a fairy of the Qisha palace. This stone would, however, often stroll along the banks of the Ling River, and having at the sight of the blade of spiritual grass been filled with admiration, it, day by day, moistened its roots with sweet dew. This purple pearl grass, at the outset, tarried for months and years, but being at a later period imbued with the essence and luxuriance of heaven and earth, and having incessantly received the moisture and nurture of the sweet dew, divested itself, in course of time, of the form of a grass, assuming, in lieu, a human nature, which gradually became perfected into the person of a girl. Every day she was wont to wander beyond the confines of the Lihen, divested animosities, heavens. When hungry she fed on the Pai Ching, hidden love, fruit; when thirsty she drank the Quan Cho, discharged sorrows, water. Having, however, up to this time, not shown her gratitude for the virtue of nurture lavished upon her, the result was but natural that she should resolve in her heart upon a constant and incessant purpose to make suitable acknowledgement. "I have been," she would often commune within herself, "the recipient of the gracious bounty of rain and dew, but I possess no such water as was lavished upon me to repay it. But should it ever descend into the world in the form of a human being, I will also betake myself thither, along with it, and if I can only have the means of making restitution to it, with the tears of a whole lifetime, I may be able to make adequate return." This resolution it is that will evolve the descent into the world of so many pleasure-bound spirits of retribution in the experience of fantastic destinies, and this crimson pearl blade will also be among the number. The stone still lies in its original place, and why should not you and I take it along before the tribunal of the monitory vision fairy, and place on its behalf its name on record, so that it should descend into the world, in company with these spirits of passion, and bring this plot to an issue? "It is indeed ridiculous," interposed the Taoist. "Never before have I heard even the very mention of restitution by means of tears. Why should not you and I avail ourselves of this opportunity to likewise go down into the world? And if successful in effecting the salvation of a few of them, will it not be a work meritorious and virtuous?" "This proposal," remarked the Buddhist, "is quite in harmony with my own views. Come along then with me to the palace of the monitory vision fairy, and let us deliver up this good-for-nothing object, and have done with it. And when the company of pleasure-bound spirits of wrath descend into human existence, you and I can then enter the world. Half of them have already fallen into the dusty universe, but the whole number of them have not, as yet, come together." "Such being the case," the Taoist acquiesced, "I am ready to follow you, whenever you please to go. But to return to Chen Shiyin." Having heard every one of these words distinctly, he could not refrain from forthwith stepping forward and paying homage. "My spiritual lords," he said, as he smiled, "accept my obeisance." The Buddhist and Taoist priests lost no time in responding to the compliment, and they exchanged the usual salutations. "My spiritual lords," Shiyin continued, "I have just heard the conversation that passed between you, on causes and effects, a conversation the like of which few mortals have forsooth listened to, but your younger brother is sluggish of intellect, and cannot lucidly fathom the import. Yet could the stallness and simplicity be graciously dispelled, your younger brother may, by listening minutely, with undefiled ear and careful attention, to a certain degree be aroused to a sense of understanding, and what is more, possibly find the means of escaping the anguish of sinking down into Hades. The two spirits smiled. "The conversation," they added, "refers to the primordial scheme and cannot be divulged before the proper season. But, when the time comes, mind do not forget us too, and you will readily be able to escape from the fiery furnace." Shi Yin, after this reply, felt it difficult to make any further inquiries. "The primordial scheme," he however remarked smiling, "cannot, of course, be divulged, but what manner of thing, I wonder, is the good-for-nothing object you alluded to a short while back? May I not be allowed to judge for myself?" "This object about which you ask," the Buddhist bonze responded, "is intended, I may tell you, by fate to be just glanced at by you." With these words he produced it, and handed it over to Shi Yin. Shi Yin received it. On scrutiny he found it, in fact, to be a beautiful gem, so lustrous and so clear that the traces of characters on the surface were distinctly visible. The characters inscribed consisted of the four Tongling Paoyu, precious gem of spiritual perception. On the obverse, were also several columns of minute words, which he was just in the act of looking at intently, when the Buddhist at once expostulated. "We have already reached," he exclaimed, "the confines of vision." Snatching it violently out of his hands, he walked away with the Taoist, under a lofty stone portal, on the face of which appeared in large type the four characters, Tai Shu Huan Qing, the visionary limits of the great void. On each side was a scroll with the lines: "When falsehood stands for truth, truth likewise becomes false, were not be made to aught, aught changes into naught." Shi Yin meant also to follow them on the other side, but, as he was about to make one step forward, he suddenly heard a crash, just as if the mountains had fallen into ruins, and the earth sunk into destruction. As Shi Yin uttered a loud shout, he looked with strained eye, but all he could see was the fiery sun shining, with glowing rays, while the banana leaves drooped their heads. By that time, half of the circumstances connected with the dream he had had, had already slipped from his memory. He also noticed a nurse coming towards him with Ying Lin in her arms. To Shi Yin's eyes his daughter appeared even more beautiful, such a bright gem, so precious, and so lovable. Forthwith stretching out his arms, he took her over, and, as he held her in his embrace, he coaxed her to play with him for a while, after which he brought her up to the street to see the great stir occasioned by the procession that was going past. He was about to come in, when he caught sight of two priests, one a Taoist, the other a Buddhist, coming hither from the opposite direction. The Buddhist had a head covered with mange, and went barefooted. The Taoist had a limping foot, and his hair was all disheveled. Like maniacs, they jostled along, chattering and laughing as they drew near. As soon as they reached Shi Yin's door, and they perceived him with Ying Lin in his arms, the bonze began to weep aloud. Turning toward Shi Yin, he said to him, "My good sir, why need you carry in your embrace this living but luckless thing, which will involve father and mother in trouble?" These words did not escape Shi Yin's ear, but persuaded that they amounted to raving talk, he paid no heed whatever to the bonze. "Part with her and give her to me," the Buddhist still went on to say. Shi Yin could not restrain his annoyance, and hastily pressing his daughter closer to him, he was intent upon going in, when the bonze pointed his hand at him, and burst out in a loud fit of laughter. He then gave utterance to the four lines that follow: "You indulge your tender daughter and are laughed at as inane, vain you face the snow, O mirror. For it will evanescent wane, when the festival of lanterns is gone by, guard gainst your doom, 'tis what time the flames will kindle, and the fire will consume." Shi Yin understood distinctly the full import of what he heard, but his heart was still full of conjectures. He was about to inquire who and what they were, when he heard the Taoist remark, "You and I cannot speak together. Let us now part company, and each of us will be then able to go after his own business. After the lapse of 3 ages, I shall be at the Paimong Mount, waiting for you, and we can, after our reunion, betake ourselves to the visionary confines of the Great Void, there to cancel the name of the stone from the records." "Excellent. First rate," exclaimed the bonze. And at the conclusion of these words, the two men parted, each going his own way, and no trace was again seen of them. These two men, Shi Yin then pondered within his heart, must have had many experiences, and I ought really to have made more inquiries of them, but at this juncture to indulge in regret is anyhow too late. While Shi Yin gave way to these foolish reflections, he suddenly noticed the arrival of a penniless scholar, Chia by surname, Hua by name, Shi Fei by style and Yutsun by nickname, who had taken up his quarters in the gourd temple next door. This Chia Yutsun was originally a denizen of Huchao, and was also of literary and official parentage, but as he was born of the youngest stock, and the possessions of his paternal and maternal ancestors were completely exhausted, and his parents and relatives were dead, He remained the sole and only survivor, and, as he found his residence in his native place of no avail, he therefore entered the capital in search of that reputation, which would enable him to put the family estate on a proper standing. He had arrived at this place since the year before last, and had, what is more, lived all along in very straitened circumstances. He had made the temple his temporary quarters, and earned a living by daily occupying himself in composing documents and writing letters for customers. Thus it was that Shi Yan had been in constant relations with him. As soon as Yu Tsun perceived Shi Yan, he lost no time in saluting him. "My worthy sir," he observed with a forced smile, "how is it you are leaning against the door and looking out? Is there perchance any news astir in the streets, or in the public places?" "None whatever," replied Shi Yan, as he returned the smile. "Just a while back, my young daughter was in sobs, and I coaxed her out here to amuse her. I am just now without anything whatever to attend to, so that, dear brother Chia, you come just in the nick of time. Please walk into my mean abode, and let us endeavor, in each other's company, to while away this long summer day." After he had made this remark, he bade his servant take his daughter in, while he, hand in hand with Yu Tsun, walked into the library, where a young page served tea. They had hardly exchanged a few sentences, when one of the household came in flying haste, to announce that Mr. Yan had come to pay a visit. Shi Yan at once stood up. "Pray excuse my rudeness," he remarked apologetically, "but do sit down, I shall shortly rejoin you, and enjoy the pleasure of your society." "My dear sir," answered Yu Tsun, as he got up, also in a conceding way, "suit your own convenience. I've often had the honor of being your guest, and what will it matter if I wait a little?" While these apologies were yet being spoken, Shi Yan had already walked out into the front parlor. During his absence, Yu Tsun occupied himself in turning over the pages of some poetical work to dispel ennui, when suddenly he heard, outside the window, a woman's cough. Yu Tsun hurriedly got up and looked out. He saw at a glance that it was a servant girl engaged in picking flowers. Her deportment was out of the common, her eyes so bright, her eyebrows so well defined. Though not a perfect beauty, she possessed nevertheless charms sufficient to arouse the feelings. Yu Tsun unwittingly gazed at her with fixed eye. This waiting maid, belonging to the Chen family, had done picking flowers, and was on the point of going in, when she of a sudden raised her eyes and became aware of the presence of some person inside the window, whose headgear consisted of a turban in tatters, while his clothes were the worse for wear. But in spite of his poverty, he was naturally endowed with a round waist, a broad back, a fat face, a square mouth. Added to this, his eyebrows were sword-like, his eyes resembled stars, his nose was straight, his cheeks square. This servant girl turned away in a hurry and made her escape. This man so burly and strong, she communed within herself, yet at the same time got up in such poor attire, must, I expect, be no one else than the man, whose name is Chia Yu Tsun or such like, time after time referred to by my master, and to whom he has repeatedly wished to give a helping hand, but has failed to find a favorable opportunity. And as related to our family there is no connection or friend in such straits, I feel certain it cannot be any other person than he. Strange to say, my master has further remarked that this man will, for a certainty, not always continue in such a state of destitution. As she indulged in this train of thought, she could not restrain herself from turning her head round once or twice. When Yu Tsun perceived that she had looked back, he readily interpreted it as a sign that in her heart her thoughts had been of him, and he was frantic with irrepressible joy. "This girl," he mused, "is, no doubt, keen-eyed and eminently shrewd, and one in this world who has seen through me." The servant youth, after a short time, came into the room, and when Yu Tsun made inquiries and found out from him that the guests in the front parlor had been detained to dinner, he could not very well wait any longer, and promptly walked away down a side passage and out of a back door. When the guests had taken their leave, Shi Yan did not go back to rejoin Yu Tsun, as he had come to know that he had already left. In time the mid-autumn festivities drew near, and Shi Yan, after the family banquet was over, had a separate table laid in the library, and crossed over, in the moonlight, as far as the temple and invited Yu Tsun to come round. The fact is that Yu Tsun, ever since the day on which he had seen the girl of the Chen family turn twice round to glance at him, flattered himself that she was friendly disposed towards him, and incessantly fostered fond thoughts of her in his heart. And on this day, which happened to be the mid-autumn feast, he could not, as he gazed at the moon, refrain from cherishing her remembrance. Hence it was that he gave vent to these pentameter verses. "Alas! Not yet divine my lifelong wish, and anguish ceaseless comes upon anguish I came, and sad at heart, my brow I frowned, she went, and oft her head to look turned round. Facing the breeze, her shadow she doth watch, whose meet this moonlight night with her to match. The lustrous rays if they my wish but read would soon alight upon her beauteous head. Yut soon having, after this recitation, recalled again to mind how that throughout his lifetime his literary attainments had had an adverse fate and not met with an opportunity of reaping distinction, went on to rub his brow, and as he raised his eyes to the skies, he heaved a deep sigh and once more intoned a couplet aloud. The gem in the cask a high price it seeks, the pin in the case to take wing it waits. As luck would have it, Sheehan was at the moment approaching, and upon hearing the lines, he said with a smile, "My dear Yutsun, really your attainments are of no ordinary capacity." Yutsun lost no time in smiling and replying. "It would be presumption in my part to think so," he observed. "I was simply at random humming a few verses composed by former writers, and what reason is there to laud me to such an excessive degree? To what, my dear sir, do I owe the pleasure of your visit?" he went on to inquire. "Tonight," replied Sheehan, "is the mid-autumn feast, generally known as the full moon festival, and as I could not help thinking that living, as you my worthy brother are, as a mere stranger in this Buddhist temple, you could not but experience the feeling of loneliness. I have, for the express purpose, prepared a small entertainment, and will be pleased if you will come to my mean abode to have a glass of wine. But I wonder whether you will entertain favorably my modest invitation?" Yutsun, after listening to the proposal, put forward no refusal of any sort, but remarked complacently, "Being the recipient of such marked attention, how can I presume to repel your generous consideration?" As he gave expression to these words, he walked off there and then, in company with Sheehan, and came over once again into the court in front of the library. In a few minutes, tea was over. The cups and dishes had been laid from an early hour, and needless to say the wines were luscious, the fare sumptuous. The two friends took their seats. At first they leisurely replenished their glasses, and quietly sipped their wine, but as, little by little, they entered into conversation, their good cheer grew more genial, and unawares the glasses began to fly round, and the cups to be exchanged. At this very hour, in every house of the neighborhood, sounded the fife and lute, while the inmates indulged in music and singing. Abovehead, the orb of the radiant moon shone with an all-pervading splendor, and with a steady lustrous light, while the two friends, as their exuberance increased, drained their cups dry so soon as they reached their lips. Yutsun, at this stage of the collation, was considerably under the influence of wine, and the vehemence of his high spirits was irrepressible. As he gazed at the moon, he fostered thoughts, to which he gave vent by the recital of a double couplet. "'Tis what time three meets five, Selena's a globe. Her pure rays fill the court, the jade-like rails enrobe. Lo! In the heavens her disk to view doth now rise, and in the earth below to gaze men lift their eyes." "Excellent!" cried Sheehan with a loud voice, after he had heard these lines, "I have repeatedly maintained that it was impossible for you to remain long inferior to any, and now the verses you have recited are a prognostic of your rapid advancement. Already it is evident that, before long, you will extend your footsteps far above the clouds. I must congratulate you. I must congratulate you. Let me, with my own hands, pour a glass of wine to pay you my compliments." Yutsun drained the cup. "What I am about to say," he explained as he suddenly heaved a sigh, "is not the maudlin talk of a man under the effects of wine. As far as the subjects at present set in the examinations go, I could, perchance, also have well been able to enter the list, and to send in my name as a candidate, but I have, just now, no means whatever to make provision for luggage and for traveling expenses. The distance to Shenqing is a long one, and I could not depend upon the sale of papers or the composition of essays to find the means of getting there." Sheehan gave him no time to conclude. "Why did you not speak about this sooner?" he interposed with haste. "I have long entertained this suspicion, but as, whenever I met you, this conversation was never broached, I did not presume to make myself officious. But if such be the state of affairs just now, I lack, I admit, literary qualification, but on the two subjects of friendly spirit and pecuniary means, I have, nevertheless, some experience. Moreover, I rejoice that next year is just the season for the triennial examinations, and you should start for the capital with all dispatch, and in the tripos next spring, you will, by carrying the prize, be able to do justice to the proficiency you can boast of. As regards the traveling expenses and the other items, the provision of everything necessary for you by my own self will again not render nugatory your mean acquaintance with me." Forthwith, he directed a servant lad to go and pack up at once 50 taels of pure silver and 2 suits of winter clothes. "The 19th," he continued, "is a propitious day, and you should lose no time in hiring a boat and starting on your journey westwards. And when, by your eminent talents, you shall have soared high to a lofty position, and we meet again next winter, will not the occasion be extremely felicitous?" Yu Tsun accepted the money and closed with but scanty expression of gratitude. In fact, he paid no thought whatever to the gifts, but went on, again drinking his wine, as he chattered and laughed. It was only when the third watch of that day had already struck that the two friends parted company, and Shi Yin, after seeing Yu Tsun off, retired to his room and slept, with one sleep all through, never waking until the sun was well up in the skies. Remembering the occurrence of the previous night, he meant to write a couple of letters of recommendation for Yu Tsun to take along with him to the capital, to enable him, after handing them over at the mansions of certain officials, to find some place as a temporary home. He accordingly dispatched a servant to ask him to come round, but the man returned and reported that from what the bond said, Mr. Chia had started on his journey to the capital, at the fifth watch of that very morning, that he had also left a message with the bonds to deliver to you, sir, to the effect that men of letters paid no heed to lucky or unlucky days, that the sole consideration with them was the nature of the matter in hand, and that he could find no time to come round in person and bid goodbye. Shi Yun, after hearing this message, had no alternative but to banish the subject from his thoughts. In comfortable circumstances, time indeed goes by with easy stride. Soon drew near also the happy festival of the 15th of the first moon, and Shi Yun told the servant Huo Qi to take Ying Lin to see the sacrificial fires and flowery lanterns. About the middle of the night, Huo Qi was hard pressed, and he forthwith set Ying Lin down on the doorstep of a certain house. When he felt relieved, he came back to take her up, but failed to find anywhere any trace of Ying Lin. In a terrible plight, Huo Qi prosecuted his search throughout half the night, but even by the dawn of day, he had not discovered any clue of her whereabouts. Huo Qi, lacking, on the other hand, the courage to go back and face his master, promptly made his escape to his native village. Shi Yin, in fact, the husband as well as the wife, seeing that their child had not come home during the whole night, readily concluded that some mishap must have befallen her. Hastily they dispatched several servants to go in search of her, but one and all returned to report that there was neither vestige nor tidings of her. This couple had only had this child, and this at the meridian of their life, so that her sudden disappearance plunged them in such great distress that day and night they mourned her loss to such a point as to well nigh pay no heed to their very lives. A month and no time went by. Shi Yin was the first to fall ill, and his wife, Dame Fang, likewise, by dint of fretting for her daughter, was also prostrated with sickness. The doctor was, day after day, sent for, and the oracle consulted by means of divination. Little did anyone think that on this day, being the 15th of the third moon, while the sacrificial oblations were being prepared in the Hulu temple, a pan with oil would have caught fire, through the want of care on the part of the bonds, and that in a short time the flames would have consumed the paper pasted on the windows. Among the natives of this district, bamboo fences and wooden partitions were in general use, and these too proved a source of calamity so ordained by fate, to consummate this decree. With promptness, the fire, extended to two buildings, then enveloped three, then dragged four, into ruin, and then spread to five houses, until the whole street was in a blaze, resembling the flames of a volcano. Though both the military and the people at once ran to the rescue, the fire had already assumed a serious hold, so that it was impossible for them to afford any effective assistance for its suppression. It blazed away straight through the night, before it was extinguished, and consumed, there is in fact no saying how many dwelling houses. Anyhow, pitiful to relate, the Chen house, situated as it was next door to the temple, was, at an early part of the evening, reduced to a heap of tiles and bricks, and nothing but the lives of that couple and several inmates of the family did not sustain any injuries. Shi Yin was in despair, but all he could do was to stamp his feet and heave deep sighs. After consulting with his wife, they betook themselves to a farm of theirs, where they took up their quarters temporarily. But as it happened that water had of late years been scarce, and no crops been reaped, robbers and thieves had sprung up like bees, and though the government troops were bent upon their capture, it was anyhow difficult to settle down quietly on the farm. He therefore had no other resource than to convert, at a loss, the whole of his property into money, and to take his wife and two servant girls and come over for shelter to the house of his father-in-law. His father-in-law, Feng Su, by name, was a native of Tajuchou. Although only a laborer, he was nevertheless in easy circumstances at home. When he on this occasion saw his son-in-law come to him in such distress, he forthwith felt at heart considerable displeasure. Fortunately, Shi Yin had still in his possession the money derived from the unprofitable realization of his property, so that he produced and handed it to his father-in-law, commissioning him to purchase, whenever a suitable opportunity presented itself, a house and land as a provision for food and raiment against days to come. This Feng Su, however, only expended the half of the sum, and pocketed the other half, merely acquiring for him some fallow land and a dilapidated house. Shi Yan being, on the other hand, a man of books and with no experience in matters connected with business and with sowing and reaping, subsisted, by hook and by crook, for about a year or two, when he became more impoverished. In his presence, Feng Su would readily give vent to specious utterances, while, with others, and behind his back, he on the contrary expressed his indignation against his improvidence in his mode of living, and against his sole delight of eating and playing the lazy. Shi Yan, aware of the want of harmony with his father-in-law, could not help giving way, in his own heart, to feelings of regret and pain. In addition to this, the fright and vexation which he had undergone the year before, the anguish and suffering he had had to endure, had already worked havoc on his constitution, and being a man advanced in years, and assailed by the joint attack of poverty and disease, he at length gradually began to display symptoms of decline. Strange coincidence, as he, on this day, came leaning on his staff and with considerable strain, as far as the street for a little relaxation, he suddenly caught sight, approaching from the offside, of a Taoist priest with a crippled foot, his maniac appearance so repulsive, his shoes of straw, his dress all in tatters, muttering several sentiments to this effect. All men's spiritual life know to be good, but fame to disregard they ne'er succeed. From old till now the statesmen where are they? Waste lie their graves, a heap of grass, extinct. All men's spiritual life know to be good, but to forget gold, silver, ill succeed. Through life they grudge their hoardings to be scant, and when plenty has come, their eyelids close. All men's spiritual life hold to be good, yet to forget wives, maids, they ne'er succeed. Who speak of grateful love while lives their Lord, and dead their Lord, another they pursue. All men's spiritual life know to be good, but sons and grandsons to forget never succeed. From old till now of parents soft many, but filial sons and grandsons who have seen? Shi Yan upon hearing these words, hastily came up to the priest. What were you so glibly holding forth? He inquired. All I could hear were a lot of hao liao, excellent, finality. You may well have heard the two words hao liao, answered the Taoist with a smile, but can you be said to have fathomed their meaning? You should know that all things in this world are excellent, when they have attained finality, when they have attained finality, they are excellent, but when they have not attained finality, they are not excellent. If they would be excellent, they should attain finality. My song is entitled Excellent Finality, Hao Liao. Shi Yan was gifted with a natural perspicacity that enabled him, as soon as he heard these remarks, to grasp their spirit. Wait a while, he therefore said smilingly, let me unravel this excellent finality song of yours, do you mind? Please by all means go on with the interpretation, urged the Taoist, whereupon Shi Yan proceeded in this strain. Sordid rooms and vacant courts, replete in years gone by with beds where statesmen lay, parched grass and withered banyan trees, where once were halls for song and dance. Spiders' webs the carved pillars intertwine, the green gauze now is also pasted on the straw windows. What about the cosmetic fresh concocted or the powder just scented? Why has the hair too on each temple become white like hoarfrost? Yesterday the tumulus of yellow earth buried the bleached bones, tonight under the red silk curtain reclines the couple. Gold fills the coffers, silver fills the boxes, but in a twinkle, the beggars will all abuse you. While you deplore that the life of others is not long, you forget that you yourself are approaching death. You educate your sons with all propriety, but they may someday, 'tis hard to say, become thieves, though you choose, your fare and home, the fatted beam, you may, who can say, fall into some place of easy virtue. Through your dislike of the gauze hat as mean, you have come to be locked in a kang. Yesterday, poor fellow, you felt cold in a tattered coat, today, you despise the purple embroidered dress as long. Confusion reigns far and wide. You have just sung your part, I come on the boards, instead of yours, you recognize another as your native land, what utter perversion. In one word, it comes to this: we make wedding clothes for others. We sow for others to reap. The crazy limping Taoist clapped his hands. Your interpretation is explicit, he remarked with a hearty laugh, your interpretation is explicit. Shi Yan promptly said nothing more than, walk on, and seizing the stole from the Taoist's shoulder, he flung it over his own. He did not, however, return home, but leisurely walked away, in company with the eccentric priest. The report of his disappearance was at once bruited abroad, and plunged the whole neighborhood in commotion, and converted into a piece of news, it was circulated from mouth to mouth. Dame Fang, Shi Yin's wife, upon hearing the tidings, had such a fit of weeping that she hung between life and death, but her only alternative was to consult with her father, and to dispatch servants on all sides to institute inquiries. No news was, however, received of him, and she had nothing else to do but to practice resignation, and to remain dependent upon the support of her parents for her subsistence. She had fortunately still by her side, to wait upon her, two servant girls, who had been with her in days gone by, and the three of them, mistress as well as servants, occupied themselves day and night with needlework, to assist her father in his daily expenses. This Feng Su had, after all, in spite of his daily murmurings against his bad luck, no help but to submit to the inevitable. On a certain day, the elder servant girl of the Chen family was at the door purchasing thread, and while there, she of a sudden heard in the street shouts of runners clearing the way, and everyone explained that the new magistrate had come to take up his office. The girl, as she peeped out from inside the door, perceived the lictors and policemen go by two, and when unexpectedly in a state chair, was carried past an official, in black hat and red coat, she was indeed quite taken aback. The face of this officer would seem familiar, she argued within herself, just as if I had seen him somewhere or other ere this. Shortly she entered the house, and banishing at once the occurrence from her mind, she did not give it a second thought. At night, however, while she was waiting to go to bed, she suddenly heard a sound like a rap at the door. A band of men boisterously cried out, "We are messengers, deputed by the worthy magistrate of this district, and come to summon one of you to an inquiry." Feng Su, upon hearing these words, fell into such a terrible consternation that his eyes stared wide and his mouth gaped. What calamity was impending is not as yet ascertained, but, reader, listen to the explanation contained in the next chapter. Chapter 2. The spirit of Mrs. Chia Shiyin departs from the town of Yangzhou. Leng Zuxing dilates upon the Yongquo mansion. To continue. Feng Su, upon hearing the shouts of the public messengers, came out in a flurry and forcing a smile, he asked them to explain their errand, but all these people did was to continue bawling out, "Be quick, and ask Mr. Chan to come out." "My surname is Feng," said Feng Su, as he promptly forced himself to smile, "it isn't Chen at all. I had once a son-in-law whose surname was Chen, but he has left home, it is now already a year or two back. Is it perchance about him that you are inquiring?" To which the public servants remarked, "We know nothing about Chen or Chia, true or false, but as he is your son-in-law, we'll take you at once along with us to make verbal answer to our master and have done with it." And forthwith the whole bevy of public servants hustled Feng Su on, as they went on their way back, while everyone in the Feng family was seized with consternation, and could not imagine what it was all about. It was no earlier than the second watch, when Feng Su returned home, and they, one and all, pressed him with questions as to what had happened. "The fact is," he explained, "the newly appointed magistrate, whose surname is Chia, whose name is Huo and who is a native of Huchao, has been on intimate terms, in years gone by, with our son-in-law, that at the sight of the girl Qiaoxing, standing at the door, in the act of buying thread, he concluded that he must have shifted his quarters over here, and hence it was that his messengers came to fetch him. I gave him a clear account of the various circumstances, of his misfortunes, and the magistrate was for a time much distressed and expressed his regret. He then went on to make inquiries about my granddaughter, and I explained that she had been lost, while looking at the illuminations. 'No matter,' put in the magistrate, 'I will by and by order my men to make search, and I feel certain that they will find her and bring her back.' Then ensued a short conversation, after which I was about to go, when he presented me with the sum of 2 taels. The mistress of the Chen family, Mrs. Chen Shiyin, could not but feel very much affected by what she heard, and the whole evening she uttered not a word. The next day, at an early hour, Yu Tsun sent some of his men to bring over to Chen's wife presents, consisting of 2 packets of silver, and 4 pieces of brocaded silk, as a token of gratitude, and to Feng Su also a confidential letter, requesting him to ask of Mrs. Chen her maid Qiaoxing to become his second wife. Feng Su was so intensely delighted that his eyebrows expanded, his eyes smiled, and he felt eager to toady to the magistrate, by presenting the girl to him. He hastened to employ all his persuasive powers with his daughter, to further his purpose, and on the same evening he forthwith escorted Qiaoxing in a small chair to the yamen. The joy experienced by Yu Tsun need not be dilated upon. He also presented Feng Su with a packet containing 100 ounces of gold, and sent numerous valuable presents to Mrs. Chen, enjoining her to live cheerfully in the anticipation of finding out the whereabouts of her daughter. It must be explained, however, that the maid Qiao Xing was the very person who, a few years ago, had looked round at Yu Tsun and who, by one simple, unpremeditated glance, evolved, in fact, this extraordinary destiny which was indeed an event beyond conception. Who would ever have foreseen that fate and fortune would both have so favored her that she should, contrary to all anticipation, give birth to a son, after living with Yu Tsun barely a year, that in addition to this, after the lapse of another half year, Yu Tsun's wife should have contracted a sudden illness and departed this life, and that Yu Tsun should have at once raised her to the rank of first wife. Her destiny is adequately expressed by the lines. Through but one single, casual look soon an exalted place she took. The fact is that after Yu Tsun had been presented with the money by Shi Yin, he promptly started on the 16th day for the capital, and at the triennial Great Tripos, his wishes were gratified to the full. Having successfully carried off his degree of graduate of the third rank, his name was put by selection on the list for provincial appointments. By this time, he had been raised to the rank of magistrate in this district, but, in spite of the excellence and sufficiency of his accomplishments and abilities, he could not escape being ambitious and overbearing. He failed besides, confident as he was in his own merits, in respect toward his superiors, with the result that these officials looked upon him scornfully with the corner of the eye. A year had hardly elapsed, when he was readily denounced in a memorial to the throne by the high provincial authorities, who represented that he was of a haughty disposition, that he had taken upon himself to introduce innovations in the rites and ceremonies, that overtly, while he endeavored to enjoy the reputation of probity and uprightness, he, secretly, combined the nature of the tiger and wolf, with the consequence that he had been the cause of much trouble in the district, and that he had made life intolerable for the people, and see. The dragon countenance of the emperor was considerably incensed. His majesty lost no time in issuing commands, in reply to the memorial, that he should be deprived of his official status. On the arrival of the dispatch from the board, great was the joy felt by every officer, without exception, of the prefecture in which he had held office. Yu Tsun, though at heart intensely mortified and incensed, betrayed not the least outward symptom of annoyance, but still preserved, as of old, a smiling and cheerful countenance. He handed over charge of all official business and removed the savings which he had accumulated during the several years he had been in office, his family and all his chattels to his original home, where, after having put everything in proper order, he himself traveled, carried the winds and sleeved the moon, far and wide, visiting every relic of note in the whole empire. As luck would have it, on a certain day while making a second journey through the Weiyang district, he heard the news that the salt commissioner appointed this year was Lin Zhuhai. This Lin Zhuhai's family name was Lin, his name Hai and his style Zhuhai. He had obtained the third place in the previous triennial examination, and had, by this time, already risen to the rank of director of the Court of Censors. He was a native of Kusu. He had been recently named by imperial appointment a censor attached to the salt inspectorate, and had arrived at his post only a short while back. In fact, the ancestors of Lin Zhuhai had, from years back, successively inherited the title of Marquis, which rank, by its present descent to Zhuhai, had already been enjoyed by five generations. When first conferred, the hereditary right to the title had been limited to three generations, but of late years, by an act of magnanimous favor and generous beneficence, extraordinary bounty had been superadded, and on the arrival of the succession to the father of Zhuhai, the right had been extended to another degree. It had now descended to Zhuhai, who had, besides this title of nobility, begun his career as a successful graduate. But though his family had been through uninterrupted ages the recipient of imperial bounties, his kindred had all been anyhow men of culture. The only misfortune had been that the several branches of the Lin family had not been prolific, so that the numbers of its members continued limited, and though there existed several households, they were all however to Zhuhai no closer relatives than first cousins. Neither were there any connections of the same lineage, or of the same parentage. Zhuhai was at this date past 40, and had only had a son, who had died the previous year, in the third year of his age. Though he had several handmaids, he had not had the good fortune of having another son, but this was too a matter that could not be remedied. By his wife, Nei Chia, he had a daughter, to whom the infant name of Tai Yu was given. She was, at this time, in her fifth year. Upon her the parents doted as much as if she were a brilliant pearl in the palm of their hand. Seeing that she was endowed with natural gifts of intelligence and good looks, they also felt solicitous to bestow upon her a certain knowledge of books, with no other purpose than that of satisfying, by this illusory way, their wishes of having a son to nurture and of dispelling the anguish felt by them, on account of the desolation and void in their family circle, round their knees. But to proceed. Yu Tsun, while sojourning at an inn, was unexpectedly laid up with a violent chill. Finding on his recovery that his funds were not sufficient to pay his expenses, he was thinking of looking out for some house where he could find a resting place when he suddenly came across two friends acquainted with the new salt commissioner. Knowing that this official was desirous to find a tutor to instruct his daughter, they lost no time in recommending Yutsun, who moved into the yamen. His female pupil was youthful in years and delicate in physique, so that her lessons were irregular. Besides herself, there were only two waiting girls, who remained in attendance during the hours of study, so that Yutsun was spared considerable trouble and had a suitable opportunity to attend to the improvement of his health. In a twinkle, another year and more slipped by, and when least expected, the mother of his ward, Nechiya, was carried away after a short illness. His pupil, during her mother's sickness, was dutiful in her attendance, and prepared the medicines for her use. And after her death, she went into the deepest mourning prescribed by the rites, and gave way to such excess of grief that, naturally delicate as she was, her old complaint, on this account, broke out anew. Being unable for a considerable time to prosecute her studies, Yutsun lived at leisure and had no duties to attend to. Whenever therefore the wind was genial and the sun mild, he was wont to stroll at random, after he had done with his meals. On this particular day, he, by some accident, extended his walk beyond the suburbs, and desirous to contemplate the nature of the rustic scenery, he, with listless step, came up to a spot encircled by hills and streaming pools, by luxuriant clumps of trees and thick groves of bamboos. Nestling in the dense foliage stood a temple. The doors and courts were in ruins. The walls, inner and outer, in disrepair. An inscription on a tablet testified that this was the temple of spiritual perception. On the sides of the door was also a pair of old and dilapidated scrolls with the following enigmatical verses. Behind ample there is, yet to retract the hand, the mind heeds not, until before the mortal vision lies no path, when comes to turn the will. These two sentences, Yutsun pondered after perusal, although simple in language, are profound in signification. I have previous to this visited many a spacious temple, located on hills of note, but never have I beheld an inscription referring to anything of the kind. The meaning contained in these words must, I feel certain, owe their origin to the experiences of some person or other, but there's no saying. But why should I not go in and inquire for myself? Upon walking in, he at a glance caught sight of no one else, but of a very aged bonze, of unkempt appearance, cooking his rice. When Yutsun perceived that he paid no notice, he went up to him and asked him one or two questions, but as the old priest was dull of hearing and a dotard, and as he had lost his teeth, and his tongue was blunt, he made most irrelevant replies. Yutsun lost all patience with him, and withdrew again from the compound with the intention of going as far as the village public house to have a drink or two, so as to enhance the enjoyment of the rustic scenery. With easy stride, he accordingly walked up to the place. Scarcely had he passed the threshold of the public house, when he perceived someone or other among the visitors who had been sitting sipping their wine on the divan, jump up and come up to greet him, with a face beaming with laughter. "What a strange meeting! What a strange meeting!" he exclaimed aloud. Yutsun speedily looked at him, and remembered that this person had, in past days, carried on business in a curio establishment in the capital, and that his surname was Lang and his style Zhu Xing. A mutual friendship had existed between them during their sojourn, in days of yore, in the capital, and as Yutsun had entertained the highest opinion of Lang Zhu Xing, as being a man of action and of great abilities, while this Lang Zhu Xing, on the other hand, barred of the reputation of refinement enjoyed by Yutsun, the two had consequently all along lived in perfect harmony and companionship. "When did you get here?" Yutsun eagerly inquired, also smilingly. "I wasn't in the least aware of your arrival. This unexpected meeting is positively a strange piece of good fortune." "I went home," Zhu Xing replied, "about the close of last year, but now as I am again bound to the capital, I passed through here on my way to look up a friend of mine and talk some matters over. He had the kindness to press me to stay with him for a couple of days longer, and as I after all have no urgent business to attend to, I am tarrying a few days, but purpose starting about the middle of the moon. My friend is busy today, so I roamed listlessly as far as here, never dreaming of such a fortunate meeting." While speaking, he made Yutsun sit down at the same table, and ordered a fresh supply of wine and eatables, and as the two friends chatted of one thing and another, they slowly sipped their wine. The conversation ran on what had occurred after the separation, and Yutsun inquired, "Is there any news of any kind in the capital?" "There's nothing new whatever," answered Zhu Xing. "There is one thing, however, in the family of one of your worthy kinsmen, of the same name as yourself, a trifling, but yet remarkable, occurrence has taken place. None of my kindred reside in the capital, rejoined Yu Tsun with a smile. To what can you be alluding? How can it be that you people who have the same surname do not belong to one clan? Remarked Zhu Xing, sarcastically. In whose family? Inquired Yu Tsun. The Chia family, replied Zhu Xing smiling, whose quarters are in the Yongquo mansion, does not after all reflect discredit upon the lintel of your door, my venerable friend. What? Exclaimed Yu Tsun, did this affair take place in that family? Were we to begin reckoning, we would find the members of my clan to be anything but limited in number. Since the time of our ancestor Chia Fu, who lived while the Eastern Han Dynasty occupied the throne, the branches of our family have been numerous and flourishing. They are now to be found in every single province, and who could, with any accuracy, ascertain their whereabouts? As regards the Yongquo branch in particular, their names are in fact inscribed on the same register as our own, but rich and exalted as they are, we have never presumed to claim them as our relatives, so that we have become more and more estranged. Don't make any such assertions, Zhu Xing remarked with a sigh, the present two mansions of Yong and Ning have both alike also suffered reverses, and they cannot come up to their state of days of yore. Up to this day, these two households of Ning and of Yong, Yu Tsun suggested, still maintain a very large retinue of people, and how can it be that they have met with reverses? To explain this would be indeed a long story, said Lang Zhu Xing. Last year, continued Yu Tsun, I arrived at Qinling, as I entertained a wish to visit the remains of interest of the six dynasties, and as I on that day entered the walled town of Shito, I passed by the entrance of that old residence. On the east side of the street, stood the Ningquo Mansion, on the west the Yongquo Mansion, and these two, adjoining each other as they do, cover in fact well nigh half of the whole length of the street. Outside the front gate everything was, it is true, lonely and deserted, but at a glance into the interior over the enclosing wall, I perceived that the halls, pavilions, two-storied structures and porches presented still a majestic and lofty appearance. Even the flower garden, which extends over the whole area of the backgrounds, with its trees and rockeries, also possessed to that day an air of luxuriance and freshness, which betrayed no signs of a ruined or decrepit establishment. You have had the good fortune of starting in life as a graduate, explained Zhu Xing as he smiled, and yet are not aware of the saying uttered by someone of old, that a centipede even when dead does not lie stiff. These families, may, according to your version, not be up to the prosperity of former years, but, compared with the family of an ordinary official, their condition anyhow presents a difference. Of late the number of the inmates has, day by day, been on the increase, their affairs have become daily more numerous, of masters and servants, high and low, who live in ease and respectability very many there are, but of those who exercise any forethought, or make any provision, there is not even one. In their daily wants, their extravagances, and their expenditure, they are also unable to adapt themselves to circumstances and practice economy, so that though, the present external framework may not have suffered any considerable collapse, their purses have anyhow begun to feel an exhausting process. But this is a mere trifle. There is another more serious matter. Would anyone ever believe that in such families of official status, in a clan of education and culture, the sons and grandsons of the present age would after all be each, succeeding, generation below the standard of the former? Yu Tsun, having listened to these remarks, observed, however can it be possible that families of such education and refinement can observe any system of training and nurture which is not excellent? Concerning the other branches, I am not in a position to say anything, but restricting myself to the two mansions of Yong and Ning, they are those in which, above all others, the education of their children is methodical. I was just now alluding to none other than these two establishments, Zhu Xing observed with a sigh, but let me tell you all. In days of yore, the Duke of Ningquo and the Duke of Yongquo were two uterine brothers. The Ning Duke was the elder, he had four sons. After the death of the Duke of Ningquo, his eldest son, Chia Taihua, came into the title. He also had two sons, but the eldest, whose name was Hu, died at the age of 8 or 9, and the only survivor, the second son, Chia Qing, inherited the title. His whole mind is at this time set upon Taoist doctrines, his sole delight is to burn the pill and refine the dual powers, while every other thought finds no place in his mind. Happily, he had, at an early age, left a son, Chia Chen, behind in the lay world, and his father, engrossed as his whole heart was with the idea of attaining spiritual life, ceded the succession of the official title to him. His parent is, besides, not willing to return to the original family seat, but lives outside the walls of the capital, foolishly hobnobbing with all the Taoist priests. This Mr. Chen had also a son, Chia Yung, who is, at this period, just in his 16th year. Mr. Chen gives it present no attention to anything at all, so that Mr. Chen naturally devotes no time to his studies, but being bent upon naught else but incessant high pleasure, he has subversed the order of things in the Ningguo mansion, and yet no one can summon the courage to come and hold him in check. But I'll now tell you about the Yung mansion for your edification. The strange occurrence, to which I alluded just now, came about in this manner. After the demise of the Yung Duke, the eldest son, Chia Taishan, inherited the rank. He took to himself as wife, the daughter of Marquess Shi, a noble family of Qinling, by whom he had two sons, the elder being Chia Shi, the younger Chia Cheng. This Taishan is now dead long ago, but his wife is still alive, and the elder son, Chia Shi, succeeded to the degree. He is a man of amiable and genial disposition, but he likewise gives no thought to the direction of any domestic concern. The second son Chia Cheng displayed, from his early childhood, a great liking for books, and grew up to be correct and upright in character. His grandfather doted upon him, and would have had him start in life through the arena of public examinations, but, when least expected, Taishan, being on the point of death, bequeathed a petition, which was laid before the emperor. His majesty, out of regard for his former minister, issued immediate commands that the elder son should inherit the estate, and further inquired how many sons there were besides him, all of whom he at once expressed a wish to be introduced in his imperial presence. His majesty, moreover, displayed exceptional favor, and conferred upon Mr. Cheng the brevet rank of second-class assistant secretary, of a board, and commanded him to enter the board to acquire the necessary experience. He has already now been promoted to the office of second-class secretary. This Mr. Cheng's wife, Nei Wang, first gave birth to a son called Chia Chu, who became a licentiate in his 14th year. At barely 20, he married, but fell ill and died soon after the birth of a son. Her, Mrs. Cheng's second child was a daughter, who came into the world, by a strange coincidence, on the first day of the year. She had an unexpected pleasure in the birth, the succeeding year, of another son, who, still more remarkable to say, had, at the time of his birth, a piece of variegated and crystal-like brilliant jade in his mouth, on which were yet visible the outlines of several characters. Now, tell me, was not this a novel and strange occurrence? Eh? Strange indeed! Exclaimed Yu Tsun with a smile, but I presume the coming experiences of this being will not be mean. Zhu Xin gave a faint smile. One and all, he remarked, entertain the same idea. Hence it is that his mother dotes upon him like upon a precious jewel. On the day of his first birthday, Mr. Cheng readily entertained a wish to put the bent of his inclinations to the test, and placed before the child all kinds of things, without number, for him to grasp from. Contrary to every expectation, he scorned every other object, and, stretching forth his hand, he simply took hold of rouge, powder and a few hairpins, with which he began to play. Mr. Cheng experienced at once displeasure, as he maintained that this youth would, by and by, grow up into a sybarite, devoted to wine and women, and for this reason it is, that he soon began to feel not much attachment for him. But his grandmother is the one who, in spite of everything, prizes him like the breath of her own life. The very mention of what happened is even strange. He is now grown up to be 7 or 8 years old, and, although exceptionally willful, in intelligence and precocity, however, not 1 in 100 could come up to him. And as for the utterances of this child, they are no less remarkable. The bones and flesh of woman, he argues, are made of water, while those of man of mud. Women to my eyes are pure and pleasing, he says, while at the sight of man, I readily feel how corrupt, foul and repelling they are. Now tell me, are not these words ridiculous? There can be no doubt whatever that he will by and by turn out to be a licentious roué. Yu Tsun, whose countenance suddenly assumed a stern air, promptly interrupted the conversation. It doesn't quite follow, he suggested. You people don't, I regret to say, understand the destiny of this child. The fact is that even the old Hanlin scholar Mr. Cheng was erroneously looked upon as a loose rake and dissolute debauchee. But unless a person, through much study of books and knowledge of letters, so increases, in lore, as to attain the talent of discerning the nature of things, and the vigor of mind to fathom the Taoist reason as well as to comprehend the first principle, he is not in a position to form any judgment. Zhu Xing, upon perceiving the weighty import of what he propounded, please explain, he asked hastily, the drift of your argument. To which Yu Tsun responded, of the human beings created by the operation of heaven and earth, if we exclude those who are gifted with extreme benevolence and extreme viciousness, the rest, for the most part, present no striking diversity. If they be extremely benevolent, They fall in, at the time of their birth, with an air of propitious fortune, while those extremely vicious correspond, at the time of their existence, with an air of calamity. When those who coexist with propitious fortune come into life, the world is in order. When those who coexist with unpropitious fortune come into life, the world is in danger. Yao, Shun, Yu, Chang Tang, Wen Wang, Wu Wang, Cho Kung, Zhao Kung, Confucius, Mencius, Tung Hu, Han Xin, Cho Zhu, Chang Zhu, Chu Zhu and Chang Zhu were ordained to see light in an auspicious era. Whereas Qi Yu, Kung Kung, Jia Wang, Cho Wang, Shi Huang, Wang Mong, Cao Cao, Wen Wen, and Hu Shan, Qin Kui and others were one and all destined to come into the world during a calamitous age. Those endowed with extreme benevolence set the world in order, those possessed of extreme maliciousness turn the world into disorder. Purity, intelligence, spirituality and subtlety constitute the vital spirit of right which pervades heaven and earth, and the persons gifted with benevolence are its natural fruit. Malignity and perversity constitute the spirit of evil, which permeates heaven and earth, and malicious persons are affected by its influence. The days of perpetual happiness and eminent good fortune, and the era of perfect peace and tranquility, which now prevail, are the offspring of the pure, intelligent, divine and subtle spirit which ascends above, to the very emperor, and below reaches the rustic and uncultured classes. Everyone is without exception under its influence. The superfluity of the subtle spirit expands far and wide, and finding nowhere to betake itself to, becomes, in due course, transformed into dew, or gentle breeze, and, by a process of diffusion, it pervades the whole world. The spirit of malignity and perversity, unable to expand under the brilliant sky and transmuting sun, eventually coagulates, pervades and stops up the deep gutters and extensive caverns, and when of a sudden the wind agitates it or it be impelled by the clouds, and any slight disposition, on its part, supervenes to set itself in motion, or to break its bounds, and so little as even the minutest fraction does unexpectedly find an outlet, and happens to come across any spirit of perception and subtlety which may be at the time passing by, the spirit of right does not yield to the spirit of evil, and the spirit of evil is again envious of the spirit of right, so that the two do not harmonize. Just like wind, water, thunder and lightning, which, when they meet in the bowels of the earth, must necessarily, as they are both to dissolve and are likewise unable to yield, clash and explode to the end that they may at length exhaust themselves. Hence it is that these spirits have also forcibly to diffuse themselves into the human race to find an outlet, so that they may then completely disperse, with the result that men and women are suddenly imbued with these spirits and spring into existence. At best, these human beings cannot be generated into philanthropists or perfect men. At worst, they cannot also embody extreme perversity or extreme wickedness. Yet placed among 1,000,000 beings, the spirit of intelligence, refinement, perception and subtlety will be above these 1,000,000 beings, while, on the other hand, the perverse, depraved and inhuman embodiment will likewise be below the million of men. Born in a noble and wealthy family, these men will be a salacious, lustful lot, born of literary, virtuous or poor parentage, they will turn out retired scholars or men of mark, though they may by some accident be born in a destitute and poverty-stricken home, they cannot possibly, in fact, ever sink so low as to become runners or menials, or contentedly brook to be of the common herd or to be driven and curbed like a horse in harness. They will become, for a certainty, either actors of note or courtesans of notoriety, as instanced in former years by Xu Yu, Tao Chen, Yuan Qi, Qi Kang, Liu Ling, the two families of Wang and She, Ku Hu To, Chen Ho Chu, Tang Ming Huang, Sung Hui Chung, Liu Ting Qi, Wen Fei Qing, Mei Nan Kung, Shi Man Qing, Lu Weihai Qing and Qin Xiaoyu, and exemplified nowadays by Ni Yun Lin, Tang Pohu, Chu Qi Shan, and also by Li Kui Men, Huang Pan Chou, Qing Xin Mo, Chou Wen Chun, and the women Hung Fu, She Tao, Chu Ying, Zhao Yun and others, all of whom were and are of the same stamp, though placed in different scenes of action. From what you say, observed Zhu Xing, success makes a man, a duke or a marquis, ruin, a thief. Quite so, that's just my idea. Replied Yu Tsun, I've not as yet let you know that after my degradation from office, I spent the last couple of years in traveling for pleasure all over each province, and that I also myself came across two extraordinary youths. This is why, when a short while back you alluded to this Pao Yu, I at once conjectured, with a good deal of certainty, that he must be a human being of the same stamp. There's no need for me to speak of any farther than the walled city of Qinling. This Mr. Chen was, by imperial appointment, named principal of the government public college of the Qinling province. Do you perhaps know him? Who doesn't know him? Remarked Zhu Xing. This Chen family is an old connection of the Chia family. These two families were on terms of great intimacy, and I myself likewise enjoyed the pleasure of their friendship for many a day. Last year, when at Qinling, Yu Tsun continued with a smile, someone recommended me as resident tutor to the school in the Chen mansion, and when I moved into it I saw for myself the state of things. Who would ever think that that household was grand and luxurious to such a degree? But they are an affluent family, and withal full of propriety, so that a school like this was of course not one easy to obtain. The pupil, however, was, it is true, a young tyro, but far more troublesome to teach than a candidate for the examination of graduate of the second degree. Were I to enter into details, you would indeed have a laugh. I must needs, he explained, have the company of two girls in my studies to enable me to read at all, and to keep likewise my brain clear. Otherwise, if left to myself, my head gets all in a muddle. Time after time, he further expounded to his young attendants, how extremely honorable and extremely pure were the two words representing woman, that they are more valuable and precious than the auspicious animal, the felicitous bird, rare flowers and uncommon plants. You may not, he was wont to say, on any account heedlessly utter them, you set of foul mouths and filthy tongues. These two words are of the utmost import. Whenever you have occasion to allude to them, you must, before you can do so with impunity, take pure water and scented tea and rinse your mouths. In the event of any slip of the tongue, I shall at once have your teeth extracted, and your eyes gouged out. His obstinacy and waywardness are, in every respect, out of the common. After he was allowed to leave school, and to return home, he became, at the sight of the young ladies, so tractable, gentle, sharp, and polite, transformed, in fact, like one of them. And though, for this reason, his father has punished him on more than one occasion, by giving him a sound thrashing, such as brought him to the verge of death, he cannot however change. Whenever he was being beaten, and could no more endure the pain, he was wont to promptly break forth in promiscuous loud shouts, "Girls! Girls!" The young ladies, who heard him from the inner chambers, subsequently made fun of him. "Why," they said, "when you are being thrashed, and you are in pain, your only thought is to bawl out, 'Girls!' Is it perchance that you expect us young ladies to go and intercede for you? How is that you have no sense of shame?" To their taunts he gave a most plausible explanation. "Once," he replied, "when in the agony of pain, I gave vent to shouting, 'Girls,' in the hope, perchance, I did not then know, of its being able to alleviate the soreness. After I had, with this purpose, given one cry, I really felt the pain considerably better, and now that I have obtained this secret spell, I have recourse, at once, when I am in the height of anguish, to shouts of 'Girls,' one shout after another. Now what do you say to this? Isn't this absurd, eh?" The grandmother is so infatuated by her extreme tenderness for this youth, that, time after time, she has, on her grandson's account, found fault with the tutor, and called her son to task, with the result that I resigned my post and took my leave. A youth, with a disposition such as his, cannot assuredly either perpetuate intact the estate of his father and grandfather, or follow the injunctions of teacher or advice of friends. The pity is, however, that there are, in that family, several excellent female cousins, the like of all of whom it would be difficult to discover. "Quite so," remarked Zhu Xing, "there are now three young ladies in the Chia family who are simply perfection itself. The eldest is a daughter of Mr. Chang, Yuan Shun by name, who, on account of her excellence, filial piety, talents, and virtue, has been selected as a governess in the palace. The second is the daughter of Mr. Xi's handmaid, and is called Ying Chun. The third is Tan Chun, the child of Mr. Cheng's handmaid, while the fourth is the uterine sister of Mr. Chen of the Ning Mansion. Her name is Xi Chun. As Dowager Lady Xi is so fondly attached to her granddaughters, they come, for the most part, over to their grandmother's place to prosecute their studies together, and each one of these girls is, I hear, without a fault." "More admirable," observed Yu Tsun, "is the regime, adhered to, in the Chen family, where the names of the female children have all been selected from the list of male names, and are unlike all those out-of-the-way names, such as spring blossom, scented gem, and the like flowery terms in vogue in other families. But how is it that the Chia family have likewise fallen into this common practice?" "Not so," ventured Zhu Xing. "It is simply because the eldest daughter was born on the first of the first moon, that the name of Yuan Chun was given to her, while with the rest this character Chun, spring, was then followed. The names of the senior generation are, in like manner, adopted from those of their brothers, and there is at present an instance in support of this. The wife of your present worthy master, Mr. Lin, is the uterine sister of Mr. Chia. She and Mr. Chia Cheng, and she went, while at home, under the name of Chia Min. Should you question the truth of what I say, you are at liberty, on your return, to make minute inquiries and you'll be convinced. Yu Tsun clapped his hands and said smiling, it's so, I know. For this female pupil of mine, whose name is Tai Yu, invariably pronounces the character Min as Mi, whenever she comes across it in the course of her reading, while, in writing, when she comes to the character Min, she likewise reduces the strokes by one, sometimes by two. Often have I speculated in my mind, as to the cause, but the remarks I've heard you mention, convince me, without doubt, that it is no other reason, than that of reverence to her mother's name. Strange enough, this pupil of mine is unique in her speech and deportment, and in no way like any ordinary young lady. But considering that her mother was no commonplace woman herself, it is natural that she should have given birth to such a child. Besides, knowing, as I do now, that she is the granddaughter of the Yong family, it is no matter of surprise to me that she is what she is. Poor girl, her mother, after all, died in the course of the last month. Zhu Xing heaved a sigh. Of three elderly sisters, he explained, this one was the youngest, and she too is gone. Of the sisters of the senior generation, not one even survives. But now we'll see what the husbands of this younger generation will be like by and by. Yes, replied Yu Tsun. But some while back you mentioned that Mr. Cheng has had a son, born with a piece of jade in his mouth, and that he is besides a tender-aged grandson left by his eldest son, but is it likely that this Mr. Xi has not, himself, as yet, had any male issue? After Mr. Cheng had this son with the jade, Zhu Xing added, his handmaid gave birth to another son, who whether he be good or bad, I don't at all know. At all events, he has by his side two sons and a grandson, but what these will grow up to be by and by, I cannot tell. As regards Mr. Chia Xi, he too has had two sons, the second of whom, Chia Lin, is by this time about 20. He took to wife a relative of his, a niece of Mr. Cheng's wife, a Miss Wang, and has now been married for the last 2 years. This Mr. Lin has lately obtained by purchase the rank of sub-prefect. He too takes little pleasure in books, but as far as worldly affairs go, he is so versatile and glib of tongue, that he has recently taken up his quarters with his uncle Mr. Cheng, to whom he gives a helping hand in the management of domestic matters. Who would have thought it, however, ever since his marriage with his worthy wife, not a single person, whether high or low, has there been who has not looked up to her with regard, with the result that Mr. Lin himself has, in fact, had to take a back seat, let withdrew 35 li. In looks, she is also so extremely beautiful, in speech so extremely quick and fluent, in ingenuity so deep and astute, that even a man could, in no way, come up to her mark. After hearing these remarks Yu Tsun smiled. You now perceive, he said, that my argument is no fallacy, and that the several persons about whom you and I have just been talking are, we may presume, human beings, who, one and all, have been generated by the spirit of right, and the spirit of evil, and come to life by the same royal road, but of course there's no saying. Enough, cried Zhu Xing, of right and enough of evil, we've been doing nothing but settling other people's accounts, come now, have another glass, and you'll be the better for it. While bent upon talking, Yu Tsun explained, I've had more glasses than is good for me. Speaking of irrelevant matters about other people, Zhu Xing rejoined complacently, is quite the thing to help us swallow our wine, so come now, what harm will happen, if we do have a few glasses more? Yu Tsun thereupon looked out of the window. The day is also far advanced, he remarked, and if we don't take care, the gates will be closing, let us leisurely enter the city, and as we go along, there will be nothing to prevent us from continuing our chat. Forthwith the two friends rose from their seats, settled and paid their wine bill, and were just going, when they unexpectedly heard someone from behind say with a loud voice, accept my congratulations, brother Yu Tsun, I've now come, with the express purpose of giving you the welcome news. Yu Tsun lost no time in turning his head round to look at the speaker. But reader, if you wish to learn who the man was, listen to the details given in the following chapter. Chapter 3. Lin Zhuhai appeals to his brother-in-law, Chia Cheng, recommending Yu Tsun, his daughter's tutor, to his consideration. Dowager Lady Chia sends to fetch her granddaughter, out of commiseration for her being a motherless child. But to proceed with our narrative. Yu Tsun, on speedily turning round, perceived that the speaker was no other than a certain Cheng Jukwei, an old colleague of his, who had been denounced and deprived of office, on account of some case or other, a native of that district, who had, since his degradation, resided in his family home. Having lately come to hear the news that a memorial, presented in the capital, that the former officers, who had been cashiered, should be reinstated, had received the imperial consent, he had promptly done all he could, in every nook and corner, to obtain influence, and to find the means, of righting his position, when he, unexpectedly, came across Yutsun, to whom he therefore lost no time in offering his congratulations. The two friends exchanged the conventional salutations, and Chang Jukui forthwith communicated the tidings to Yutsun. Yutsun was delighted, but after he had made a few remarks, in a great hurry, each took his leave and sped on his own way homewards. Lang Zuxing, upon hearing this conversation, hastened at once to propose a plan, advising Yutsun to request Lin Zhuhai, in his turn, to appeal in the capital to Mr. Chia Chang for support. Yutsun accepted the suggestion, and parted from his companion. On his return to his quarters, he made all haste to lay his hand on the Metropolitan Gazette, and having ascertained that the news was authentic, he had on the next day a personal consultation with Zhuhai. "Providence and good fortune are both alike propitious," exclaimed Zhuhai. "After the death of my wife, my mother-in-law, whose residence is in the capital, was so very solicitous on my daughter's account, for having no one to depend upon, that she dispatched, at an early period, boats with men and women servants to come and fetch her. But my child was at the time not quite over her illness, and that is why she has not yet started. I was, this very moment, cogitating to send my daughter to the capital. And in view of the obligation, under which I am to you for the instruction you have heretofore conferred upon her, remaining as yet unrequited, there is no reason why, when such an opportunity as this presents itself, I should not do my utmost to find means to make proper acknowledgement. I have already, in anticipation, given the matter my attention, and written a letter of recommendation to my brother-in-law, urging him to put everything right for you, in order that I may, to a certain extent, be able to give effect to my modest wishes. As for any outlay that may prove necessary, I have given proper explanation, in the letter to my brother-in-law, so that you, my brother, need not trouble yourself by giving way to much anxiety." As Yutsun bowed and expressed his appreciation in most profuse language, dash. "Pray," he asked, "where does your honored brother-in-law reside? And what is his official capacity? But I fear I'm too coarse in my manner, and could not presume to obtrude myself in his presence." Zhuhai smiled. "And yet," he remarked, "this brother-in-law of mine is after all of one and the same family as your worthy self, for he is the grandson of the Duke Yung. My elder brother-in-law has now inherited the status of Captain General of the First Grade. His name is Shi, his style Enjin Ho. My second brother-in-law's name is Cheng, his style is Zuchou. His present post is that of a second-class secretary in the Board of Works. He is modest and kind-hearted, and has much in him of the habits of his grandfather, not one of that purse-proud and haughty kind of men. That is why I have written to him and made the request on your behalf. Were he different to what he really is, not only would he cast a slur upon your honest purpose, honorable brother, but I myself likewise would not have been as prompt in taking action." When Yutsun heard these remarks, he at length credited what had been told him by Zuxing the day before, and he lost no time in again expressing his sense of gratitude to Lin Zhuhai. Zhuhai resumed the conversation. "I have fixed," he explained, "upon the 2nd of next month, for my young daughter's departure for the capital, and, if you, brother mine, were to travel along with her, would it not be an advantage to herself, as well as to yourself?" Yutsun signified his acquiescence as he listened to his proposal, feeling in his inner self extremely elated. Zhuhai availed himself of the earliest opportunity to get ready the presents, for the capital, and all the requirements for the journey, which, when completed, Yutsun took over one by one. His pupil could not, at first, brook the idea of a separation from her father, but the pressing wishes of her grandmother left her no course, but to comply. "Your father," Zhuhai furthermore argued with her, "is already 50, and I entertain no wish to marry again, and then you are always ailing. Besides, with your extreme youth, you have, above, no mother of your own to take care of you, and below, no sisters to attend to you. If you now go and have your maternal grandmother, as well as your mother's brothers and your cousins to depend upon, you will be doing the best thing to reduce the anxiety which I feel in my heart on your behalf. Why then should you not go?" Tai Yu, after listening to what her father had to say, parted from him in a flood of tears and followed her nurse and several old matrons from the Yung mansion on board her boat, and set out on her journey. Yutsun had a boat to himself, and with two youths to wait on him, he prosecuted his voyage in the wake of Tai Yu. By a certain day, they reached Chengdu, and Yu Tsun, after first adjusting his hat and clothes, came, attended by a youth, to the door of the Yong mansion, and sent in a card, which showed his lineage. Xia Cheng had, by this time, perused his brother-in-law's letter, and he speedily asked him to walk in. When they met, he found in Yu Tsun an imposing manner and polite address. This Xia Cheng had, in fact, a great penchant above all things for men of education, men courteous to the talented, respectful to the learned, ready to lend a helping hand to the needy and to succor the distressed, and was, to a great extent, like his grandfather. As it was besides a wish intimated by his brother-in-law, he therefore treated Yu Tsun with a consideration still more unusual, and readily strained all his resources to assist him. On the very day on which the memorial was submitted to the throne, he obtained by his efforts, a reinstatement to office, and before the expiry of 2 months, Yu Tsun was forthwith selected to fill the appointment of prefect of Yingtian and Qinling. Taking leave of Xia Cheng, he chose a propitious day, and proceeded to his post, where we will leave him without further notice for the present. But to return to Taiyu. On the day on which she left the boat, and the moment she put her foot on shore, there were forthwith at her disposal chairs for her own use, and carts for the luggage, sent over from the Yong mansion. Lin Taiyu had often heard her mother recount how different was her grandmother's house from that of other people's, and having seen for herself how above the common run were already the attendants of the three grades, sent to wait upon her, in attire, in their fare, in all their articles of use, how much more, she thought to herself, now that I am going to her home, must I be careful at every step, and circumspect at every moment. Nor must I utter one word too many, nor make one step more than is proper, for fear lest I should be ridiculed by any of them. From the moment she got into the chair, and they had entered within the city walls, she found, as she looked around, through the gauze window, at the bustle in the streets and public places and at the immense concourse of people, everything naturally so unlike what she had seen elsewhere. After they had also been a considerable time on the way, she suddenly caught sight, at the northern end of the street, of two huge squatting lions of marble and of three lofty gates with, knockers representing, the heads of animals. In front of these gates, sat, in a row, about 10 men in colored hats and fine attire. The main gate was not open. It was only through the side gates, on the east and west, that people went in and came out. Above the center gate was a tablet. On this tablet were inscribed in 5 large characters the Ningquo Mansion erected by Imperial Command. This must be grandmother's eldest son's residence, reflected Taiyu. Towards the east, again, at no great distance, were 3 more high gateways, likewise of the same kind as those she had just seen. This was the Yongquo Mansion. They did not, however, go in by the main gate, but simply made their entrance through the east side door. With the sedans on their shoulders, the bearers proceeded about the distance of the throw of an arrow, when upon turning a corner, they hastily put down the chairs. The matrons, who came behind, one and all also dismounted. The bearers were changed for 4 youths of 17 or 18, with hats and clothes without a blemish, and while they carried the chair, the whole bevy of matrons followed on foot. When they reached the creeper-laden gate, the sedan was put down, and all the youths stepped back and retired. The matrons came forward, raised the screen, and supported Taiyu to descend from the chair. Lin Taiyu entered the door with the creepers, resting on the hand of a matron. On both sides was a veranda, like 2 outstretched arms. An entrance hall stood in the center, in the middle of which was a door screen of Tali marble, set in an ebony frame. On the other side of this screen were 3 very small halls. At the back of these came at once an extensive courtyard, belonging to the main building. In the front part were 5 parlors, the frieze of the ceiling of which was all carved, and the pillars ornamented. On either side, were covered avenues, resembling passages through a rock. In the side rooms were suspended cages, full of parrots of every color, thrushes, and birds of every description. On the terrace steps, sat several waiting maids, dressed in red and green, and the whole company of them advanced, with beaming faces, to greet them, when they saw the party approach. Her venerable ladyship, they said, was at this very moment thinking of you, miss, and, by a strange coincidence, here you are. 3 or 4 of them forthwith vied with each other in raising the door curtain, while at the same time was heard someone announce, Miss Lin has arrived. No sooner had she entered the room, than she espied 2 servants supporting a venerable lady, with silver-white hair, coming forward to greet her. Convinced that this lady must be her grandmother, she was about to prostrate herself and pay her obeisance, when she was quickly clasped in the arms of her grandmother, who held her close against her bosom, and as she called her my liver, my flesh, my love, My darling, she began to sob aloud. The bystanders too, at once, without one exception, melted into tears, and Taiyu herself found some difficulty in restraining her sobs. Little by little the whole party succeeded in consoling her, and Taiyu at length paid her obeisance to her grandmother. Her ladyship thereupon pointed them out one by one to Taiyu. "This," she said, "is the wife of your uncle, your mother's elder brother, this is the wife of your uncle, her second brother, and this is your eldest sister-in-law Chu, the wife of your senior cousin Chu." Taiyu bowed to each one of them, with folded arms. "Ask the young ladies in," Dowager Lady Chia went on to say, "tell them a guest from afar has just arrived, one who comes for the first time, and that they may not go to their lessons." The servants with one voice signified their obedience, and two of them speedily went to carry out her orders. Not long after, three nurses and five or six waiting maids were seen ushering in three young ladies. The first was somewhat plump in figure and of medium height, her cheeks had a congealed appearance, like a fresh lychee, her nose was glossy like goose fat. She was gracious, demure, and lovable to look at. The second had sloping shoulders, and a slim waist. Tall and slender was she in stature, with a face like the egg of a goose. Her eyes so beautiful, with their well-curved eyebrows, possessed in their gaze a bewitching flash. At the very sight of her refined and elegant manners, all idea of vulgarity was forgotten. The third was below the medium size, and her mien was, as yet, childlike. In their head ornaments, jewelry, and dress, the get-up of the three young ladies was identical. Taiyu speedily rose to greet them and to exchange salutations. After they had made each other's acquaintance, they all took a seat, whereupon the servants brought the tea. Their conversation was confined to Taiyu's mother, how she had fallen ill, what doctors had attended her, what medicines had been given her, and how she had been buried and mourned, and Dowager Lady Chia was naturally again in great anguish. "Of all my daughters," she remarked, "your mother was the one I loved best, and now in a twinkle, she has passed away, before me too, and I've not been able to so much as see her face. How can this not make my heart sore stricken?" And as she gave vent to these feelings, she took Taiyu's hand in hers, and again gave way to sobs, and it was only after the members of the family had quickly made use of much exhortation and coaxing, that they succeeded, little by little, in stopping her tears. They all perceived that Taiyu, despite her youthful years and appearance, was ladylike in her deportment and address, and that though with her delicate figure and countenance, she seemed as if, unable to bear the very weight of her clothes, she possessed, however, a certain captivating air. And as they readily noticed the symptoms of a weak constitution, they went on in consequence to make inquiries as to what medicines she ordinarily took, and how it was that her complaint had not been cured. "I have," explained Taiyu, "been in this state ever since I was born, though I've taken medicines from the very time I was able to eat rice, up to the present, and have been treated by ever so many doctors of note, I've not derived any benefit. In the year when I was yet only 3, I remember a mangy-headed bonze coming to our house, and saying that he would take me along, and make a nun of me, but my father and mother would, on no account, give their consent. As you cannot bear to part from her and to give her up," he then remarked, "her ailment will, I fear, never, throughout her life, be cured. If you wish to see her all right, it is only to be done by not letting her, from this day forward, on any account, listen to the sound of weeping, or see, with the exception of her parents, any relatives outside the family circle. Then alone will she be able to go through this existence in peace and in quiet." No one heeded the nonsensical talk of this raving priest, but here am I, up to this very day, dosing myself with ginseng pills as a tonic. "What a lucky coincidence," interposed Dowager Lady Chia. "Some of these pills are being compounded here, and I'll simply tell them to have an extra supply made, that's all." Hardly had she finished these words, when a sound of laughter was heard from the back courtyard. "Here I am too late," the voice said, and not in time to receive the distant visitor. "Every one of all these people," reflected Taiyu, "holds her peace and suppresses the very breath of her mouth, and who, I wonder, is this coming in this reckless and rude manner?" While, as yet, preoccupied with these thoughts, she caught sight of a crowd of married women and waiting maids enter from the back room, pressing round a regular beauty. The attire of this person bore no similarity to that of the young ladies. In all her splendor and luster, she looked like a fairy or a goddess. In her coiffure, she had a band of gold filigree work, representing the 8 precious things, inlaid with pearls, and wore pins, at the head of each of which were 5 phoenixes in a rampant position, with pendants of pearls. On her neck, she had a reddish gold necklet, like coiled dragons, with a fringe of tassels. On her person, she wore a tight-sleeved jacket, of dark red flowered satin, covered with hundreds of butterflies, embroidered in gold, interspersed with flowers. Overall, she had a variegated stiff silk pelisse, lined with slate blue ermine, while her nether garments consisted of a jupe of kingfisher color foreign crepe, brocaded with flowers. She had a pair of eyes, triangular in shape like those of the red phoenix, two eyebrows, curved upwards at each temple, like willow leaves. Her stature was elegant, her figure graceful, her powdered face like dawning spring, majestic, yet not haughty. Her carnation lips, long before they parted, betrayed a smile. Tai Yu eagerly rose and greeted her. Old Lady Chia then smiled. "You don't know her," she observed. "This is a cunning vixen, who has made quite a name in this establishment. In Nanking, she went by the appellation of vixen, and if you simply call her Feng Vixen, it will do." Tai Yu was just at a loss how to address her, when all her cousins informed Tai Yu that this was her sister-in-law Lin. Tai Yu had not, it is true, made her acquaintance before, but she had heard her mother mention that her eldest maternal uncle Chia Shi's son, Chia Lin, had married the niece of Madame Wang, her second brother's wife, a girl who had, from her infancy, purposely been nurtured to supply the place of a son, and to whom the school name of Wang Shifeng had been given. Tai Yu lost no time in returning her smile and saluting her with all propriety, addressing her as my sister-in-law. This Shifeng laid hold of Tai Yu's hand, and minutely scrutinized her, for a while, from head to foot, after which she led her back next to Dowager Lady Chia, where they both took a seat. "If really there be a being of such beauty in the world," she consequently observed with a smile, "I may well consider as having set eyes upon it today. Besides, in the air of her whole person, she doesn't in fact look like your granddaughter-in-law, our worthy ancestor, but in every way like your ladyship's own kindred granddaughter. It's no wonder then that your venerable ladyship should have, day after day, had her unforgotten, even for a second, in your lips and heart. It's a pity, however, that this cousin of mine should have such a hard lot. How did it happen that our aunt died at such an early period?" As she uttered these words, she hastily took her handkerchief and wiped the tears from her eyes. "I've only just recovered from a fit of crying," Dowager Lady Chia observed, as she smiled, "and have you again come to start me? Your cousin has only now arrived from a distant journey, and she is so delicate to boot. Besides, we have a few minutes back succeeded in coaxing her to restrain her sobs, so drop at once making any allusion to your former remarks." This Shifeng, upon hearing these words, lost no time in converting her sorrow into joy. "Quite right," she remarked. "But at the sight of my cousin, my whole heart was absorbed in her, and I felt happy, and yet wounded at heart, but having disregarded my venerable ancestor's presence, I deserve to be beaten, I do indeed." And hastily taking once more Tai Yu's hand in her own, "How old are you, cousin?" she inquired, "have you been to school? What medicines are you taking? While you live here, you mustn't feel homesick, and if there's anything you would like to eat, or to play with, mind you come and tell me. Or should the waiting maids or the matrons fail in their duties, don't forget also to report them to me." Addressing at the same time the matrons, she went on to ask, "Have Miss Lin's luggage and effects been brought in? How many servants has she brought along with her? Go, as soon as you can, and sweep two lower rooms and ask them to go and rest." As she spake, tea and refreshments had already been served, and Shifeng herself handed round the cups and offered the fruits. Upon hearing the question further put by her maternal aunt Secunda, whether the issue of the monthly allowances of money had been finished or not yet? Shifeng replied, "The issue of the money has also been completed, but a few moments back, when I went along with several servants to the back upper loft, in search of the satins, we looked for ever so long, but we saw nothing of the kind of satins alluded to by you, madam, yesterday, so may it not be that your memory misgives you." "Whether there be any or not, of that special kind, is of no consequence," observed Madame Wang. "You should take out," she therefore went on to add, "any two pieces which first come under your hand, for this cousin of yours to make herself dresses with, and in the evening, if I don't forget, I'll send someone to fetch them." "I've in fact already made every provision," rejoined Shifeng, "knowing very well that my cousin would be arriving within these 2 days, I have had everything got ready for her. And when you, madam, go back, if you will pass an eye over everything, I shall be able to send them round." Madame Wang gave a smile, nodded her head assentingly, but uttered not a word by way of reply. The tea and fruit had by this time been cleared, and Dowager Lady Chia directed two old nurses to take Tai Yu to go and see her two maternal uncles, whereupon Chia Shi's wife, Madame Xing, hastily stood up and with a smiling face suggested, "I'll take my niece over, for it will after all be considerably better if I go. Quite so, answered Dowager Lady Chia, smiling, you can go home too, and there will be no need for you to come over again. Madam Xing expressed her assent, and forthwith led Tai Yu to take leave of Madam Wang. The whole party escorted them as far as the door of the entrance hall, hung with creepers, where several youths had drawn a carriage, painted light blue, with a kingfisher-colored hood. Madam Xing led Tai Yu by the hand and they got up into their seats. The whole company of matrons put the curtain down, and then bade the youths raise the carriage, who dragged it along, until they came to an open space, where they at length put the mules into harness. Going out again by the eastern side gate, they proceeded in an easterly direction, past the main entrance of the Yong Mansion, and entered a lofty doorway painted black. On the arrival in front of the ceremonial gate, they at once dismounted from the curricle, and Madam Xing, hand in hand with Tai Yu, walked into the court. These grounds, surmised Tai Yu to herself, must have been originally converted from a peace partition from the garden of the Yong Mansion. Having entered three rows of ceremonial gates, they actually caught sight of the main structure, with its vestibules and porches, all of which, though on a small scale, were full of artistic and unique beauty. They were nothing like the lofty, imposing, massive and luxurious style of architecture on the other side, yet the avenues and rockeries, in the various places in the court, were all in perfect taste. When they reached the interior of the principal pavilion, a large concourse of handmaids and waiting maids, got up in gala dress, were already there to greet them. Madam Xing pressed Tai Yu into a seat, while she bade someone go into the outer library and request Mr. Chia Shi to come over. In a few minutes the servant returned. Master, she explained, says, that he has not felt quite well for several days, that as the meeting with Miss Lin will affect both her as well as himself, he does not for the present feel equal to seeing each other, that he advises Miss Lin not to feel despondent or homesick, that she ought to feel quite at home with her venerable ladyship, her grandmother, as well as her maternal aunts, that her cousins are, it is true, blunt, but that if all the young ladies associated together in one place, they may also perchance dispel some dullness, that if ever, Miss Lin, has any grievance, she should at once speak out, and on no account feel a stranger, and everything will then be right. Tai Yu lost no time in respectfully standing up, resuming her seat after she had listened to every sentence of the message to her. After a while, she said goodbye, and though Madam Xing used every argument to induce her to stay for the repast and then leave, Tai Yu smiled and said, I shouldn't under ordinary circumstances refuse the invitation to dinner, which you, and, in your love kindly extend to me, but I have still to cross over and pay my respects to my maternal uncle Secundus. If I went too late, it would, I fear, be a lack of respect on my part, but I shall accept on another occasion. I hope therefore that you will, dear aunt, kindly excuse me. If such be the case, Madam Xing replied, it's all right. And presently directing two nurses to take her niece over, in the carriage, in which they had come a while back, Tai Yu thereupon took her leave, Madam Xing escorting her as far as the ceremonial gate, where she gave some further directions to all the company of servants. She followed the curricle with her eyes so long as it remained in sight, and at length retraced her footsteps. Tai Yu shortly entered the Yong Mansion, descended from the carriage, and preceded by all the nurses, she at once proceeded towards the east, turned a corner, passed through an entrance hall, running east and west, and walked in a southern direction, at the back of a large hall. On the inner side of a ceremonial gate, and at the upper end of a spacious court, stood a large main building, with five apartments, flanked on both sides by outhouses, stretching out, like the antlers on the head of deer, side gates, resembling passages through a hill, establishing a thorough communication all round. A main building, lofty, majestic, solid and grand, and unlike those in the compound of Dowager Lady Chia. Tai Yu readily concluded that this at last was the main inner suite of apartments. A raised broad road led in a straight line to the large gate. Upon entering the hall, and raising her head, she first of all perceived before her a large tablet with blue ground, upon which figured nine dragons of reddish gold. The inscription on this tablet consisted of three characters as large as a peck measure, and declared that this was the Hall of Glorious Felicity. At the end, was a row of characters of minute size, denoting the year, month and day, upon which His Majesty had been pleased to confer the tablet upon Chia Yuan, Duke of Yongquo. Besides this tablet, were numberless costly articles bearing the autograph of the Emperor. On the large black ebony table, engraved with dragons, were placed three antique blue and green bronze tripods, about 3 feet in height. On the wall hung a large picture representing black dragons, such as were seen in waiting chambers of the Sui dynasty. On one side stood a gold cup of chased work, while on the other, a crystal casket. On the ground were placed, in two rows, 16 chairs, made of hard-grained cedar. There was also a pair of scrolls consisting of blackwood antithetical tablets, inlaid with the strokes of words in chased gold. Their burden was this. On the platform shine resplendent pearls like sun or moon, and the sheen of the hall facade gleams like russet sky. Below, was a row of small characters, denoting that the scroll had been written by the hand of Mu Shi, a fellow countryman and old friend of the family, who, for his meritorious services, had the hereditary title of Prince of Tongan'an conferred upon him. The fact is that Madam Wang was also not in the habit of sitting and resting, in this main apartment, but in three side rooms on the east, so that the nurses at once led Tai Yu through the door of the eastern wing. On a stove couch, near the window, was spread a foreign red carpet. On the side of honor, were laid deep red reclining cushions, with dragons, with gold cash, for scales, and an oblong brown-colored sitting cushion with gold cash spotted dragons. On the two sides, stood one of a pair of small teapoys of foreign lacquer of peach blossom pattern. On the teapoy on the left, were spread out Wenwang tripods, spoons, chopsticks and scent bottles. On the teapoy on the right, were vases from the Ju Kiln, painted with girls of great beauty, in which were placed seasonable flowers. On it were, also teacups, a tea service and the like articles. On the floor on the west side of the room, were four chairs in a row, all of which were covered with antimacassars, embroidered with silver and shred flowers, while below, at the feet of these chairs, stood four footstools. On either side, was also one of a pair of high teapoys, and these teapoys were covered with teacups and flower vases. The other knickknacks need not be minutely described. The old nurses pressed Tai Yu to sit down on the stove couch, but, on perceiving near the edge of the couch two embroidered cushions, placed one opposite the other, she thought of the gradation of seats, and did not therefore place herself on the couch, but on a chair on the eastern side of the room, whereupon the waiting maids, in attendance in these quarters, hastened to serve the tea. While Tai Yu was sipping her tea, she observed the headgear, dress, deportment and manners of the several waiting maids, which she really found so unlike what she had seen in other households. She had hardly finished her tea, when she noticed a waiting maid approach, dressed in a red satin jacket, and a waistcoat of blue satin with scallops. "My lady requests Miss Lin to come over and sit with her," she remarked as she put on a smile. The old nurses, upon hearing this message, speedily ushered Tai Yu again out of this apartment, into the three-room small main building by the eastern porch. On the stove couch, situated at the principal part of the room, was placed, in a transverse position, a low couch table, at the upper end of which were laid out, in a heap, books and a tea service. Against the partition wall, on the east side, facing the west, was a reclining pillow, made of blue satin, neither old nor new. Madam Wang, however, occupied the lower seat, on the west side, on which was likewise placed a rather shabby blue satin sitting rug, with a back cushion, and upon perceiving Tai Yu come in she urged her at once to sit on the east side. Tai Yu concluded, in her mind, that this seat must certainly belong to Chia Cheng, and espying, next to the couch, a row of three chairs, covered with antimacassars, strewn with embroidered flowers, somewhat also the worse for use, Tai Yu sat down on one of these chairs. But as Madam Wang pressed her again and again to sit on the couch, Tai Yu had at length to take a seat next to her. "Your uncle," Madam Wang explained, "is gone to observe this day as a fast day, but you'll see him by and by. There's, however, one thing I want to talk to you about. Your three female cousins are all, it is true, everything that is nice, and you will, when later on you come together for study, or to learn how to do needlework, or whenever, at any time, you romp and laugh together, find them all most obliging, but there's one thing that causes me very much concern. I have here one, who is the very root of retribution, the incarnation of all mischief, one who is a ne'er-do-well, a prince of malignant spirits in this family. He is gone today to pay his vows in the temple, and is not back yet, but you will see him in the evening, when you will readily be able to judge for yourself. One thing you must do, and that is, from this time forth, not to pay any notice to him. All these cousins of yours don't venture to bring any taint upon themselves by provoking him." Tai Yu had in days gone by heard her mother explain that she had a nephew, born into the world, holding a piece of jade in his mouth, who was perverse beyond measure, who took no pleasure in his books, and whose sole great delight was to play the giddy dog in the inner apartments, that her maternal grandmother, on the other hand, loved him so fondly that no one ever presumed to call him to account, so that when, in this instance, she heard Madam Wang's advice, She at once felt certain that it must be this very cousin. "Isn't it to the cousin born with jade in his mouth that you are alluding to, aunt?" she inquired as she returned her smile. "When I was at home, I remember my mother telling me more than once of this very cousin, who, she said, was a year older than I, and whose infant name was Pao Yu." She added that his disposition was really wayward, but that he treats all his cousins with the utmost consideration. "Besides, now that I have come here, I shall, of course, be always together with my female cousins, while the boys will have their own court, and separate quarters, and however will there be any cause of bringing any slur upon myself by provoking him?" "You don't know the reasons that prompt me to warn you," replied Madame Wang laughingly. "He is so unlike all the rest, all because he has, since his youth up, been doted upon by our old lady. The fact is that he has been spoilt, through overindulgence, by being always in the company of his female cousins. If his female cousins pay no heed to him, he is, at any rate, somewhat orderly, but the day his cousins say one word more to him than usual, much trouble forthwith arises, at the outburst of delight in his heart. That's why I enjoin upon you not to heed him. From his mouth, at one time, issue sugared words and mellifluous phrases, and at another, like the heavens devoid of the sun, he becomes a raving fool, so whatever you do, don't believe all he says." Tai Yu was assenting to every bit of advice as it was uttered, when unexpectedly she beheld a waiting maid walk in. "Her venerable ladyship over there," she said, "has sent word about the evening meal." Madame Wang hastily took Tai Yu by the hand, and emerging by the door of the back room, they went eastwards by the veranda at the back. Past the side gate was a roadway, running north and south. On the southern side were a pavilion with three divisions and a reception hall with a colonnade. On the north stood a large screen wall, painted white. Behind it was a very small building, with a door of half the ordinary size. "These are your cousin Feng's rooms," explained Madame Wang to Tai Yu, as she pointed to them smiling. "You'll know in future your way to come and find her, and if you ever lack anything, mind you mention it to her, and she'll make it all right." At the door of this court were also several youths, who had recently had the tufts of their hair tied together, who all dropped their hands against their sides, and stood in a respectful posture. Madame Wang then led Tai Yu by the hand through a corridor, running east and west, into what was Dowager Lady Chia's back court. Forthwith they entered the door of the back suite of rooms, where stood, already in attendance, a large number of servants, who, when they saw Madame Wang arrive, set to work setting the tables and chairs in order. Chia Chu's wife, Naili, served the eatables, while Shi Feng placed the chopsticks, and Madame Wang brought the soup in. Dowager Lady Chia was seated all alone on the divan, in the main part of the apartment, on the two sides of which stood four vacant chairs. Shi Feng at once drew Tai Yu, meaning to make her sit in the foremost chair on the left side, but Tai Yu steadily and concedingly declined. "Your aunts and sisters-in-law, standing on the right and left," Dowager Lady Chia smilingly explained, "won't have their repast in here, and as you're a guest, it's but proper that you should take that seat." Then alone it was that Tai Yu asked for permission to sit down, seating herself on the chair. Madame Wang likewise took a seat at old Lady Chia's instance, and the three cousins, Ying Chun and the others, having craved for leave to sit down, at length came forward, and Ying Chun took the first chair on the right, Dan Chun the second, and Shi Chun the second on the left. Waiting maids stood by holding in their hands flips and finger bowls and napkins, while Mrs. Li and Lady Fang, the two of them, kept near the table advising them what to eat, and pressing them to help themselves. In the outer apartments, the married women and waiting maids in attendance were, it is true, very numerous, but not even so much as the sound of the cawing of a crow could be heard. The repast over, each one was presented by a waiting maid with tea in a small tea tray, but the Lin family had all along impressed upon the mind of their daughter that in order to show due regard to happiness, and to preserve good health, it was essential, after every meal, to wait a while, before drinking any tea, so that it should not do any harm to the intestines. When, therefore, Tai Yu perceived how many habits there were in this establishment unlike those which prevailed in her home, she too had no alternative but to conform herself to a certain extent with them. Upon taking over the cup of tea, servants came once more and presented finger bowls for them to rinse their mouths, and Tai Yu also rinsed hers, and after they had all again finished washing their hands, tea was eventually served a second time, and this was, at length, the tea that was intended to be drunk. "You can all go," observed Dowager Lady Chia, "and let us alone to have a chat." Madame Wang rose as soon as she heard these words, and having made a few irrelevant remarks, she led the way and left the room along with the two ladies, Mrs. Li and Lady Fang. Dowager Lady Chia, having inquired of Tai Yu what books she was reading, "I have just begun reading the four books," Tai Yu replied. "What books are my cousins reading?" Tai Yu went on to ask. "Books, you say?" exclaimed Dowager Lady Chia. "Why, all they know are a few characters, that's all." The sentence was barely out of her lips, when a continuous sounding of footsteps was heard outside, and a waiting maid entered and announced that Pao Yu was coming. Tai Yu was speculating in her mind how it was that this Pao Yu had turned out such a good-for-nothing fellow, when he happened to walk in. He was, in fact, a young man of tender years, wearing on his head, to hold his hair together, a cap of gold at purplish tinge, inlaid with precious gems. Parallel with his eyebrows was attached a circlet, embroidered with gold, and representing two dragons snatching a pearl. He wore an archery-sleeved deep red jacket, with hundreds of butterflies worked in gold of two different shades, interspersed with flowers, and was girded with a sash of variegated silk, with clusters of designs, to which was attached long tassels, a kind of sash worn in the palace. Overall, he had a slate-blue fringed coat of Japanese brocaded satin, with eight bunches of flowers in relief, and wore a pair of light blue satin wide-soled, half-dress court shoes. His face was like the full moon at mid-autumn, his complexion, like morning flowers in spring, the hair along his temples, as if chiseled with a knife, his eyebrows, as if penciled with ink, his nose like a suspended gallbladder, a well-cut and shapely nose, his eyes like vernal waves, his angry look even resembled a smile, his glance, even when stern, was full of sentiment. Round his neck he had a gold dragon necklet with a fringe, also a cord of variegated silk, to which was attached a piece of beautiful jade. As soon as Tai Yu became conscious of his presence, she was quite taken aback. "How very strange," she was reflecting in her mind, "it would seem as if I had seen him somewhere other, for his face appears extremely familiar to my eyes," when she noticed Pao Yu face Dowager Lady Chia and make his obeisance. "Go and see your mother and then come back," remarked her venerable ladyship, and at once he turned round and quitted the room. On his return, he had already changed his hat and suit. All round his head, he had a fringe of short hair, plaited into small queues, and bound with red silk. The queues were gathered up at the crown, and all the hair, which had been allowed to grow since his birth, was plaited into a thick queue, which looked as black and as glossy as lacquer. Between the crown of the head and the extremity of the queue, hung a string of four large pearls, with pendants of gold, representing the eight precious things. On his person, he wore a long silvery red coat, more or less old, bestrewn with embroidery of flowers. He had still round his neck the necklet, precious gem, amulet of recorded name, phylacteries, and other ornaments. Below were partly visible a fur cone-colored brocaded silk pair of trousers, socks spotted with black designs, with ornamented edges, and a pair of deep red, thick-soled shoes. Got up as he was now, his face displayed a still whiter appearance, as if painted, and his eyes as if they were set off with carnation. As he rolled his eyes, they brimmed with love. When he gave utterance to speech, he seemed to smile. But the chief natural pleasing feature was mainly centered in the curve of his eyebrows. The 10,001 fond sentiments, fostered by him during the whole of his existence, were all amassed in the corner of his eyes. His outward appearance may have been pleasing to the highest degree, but yet it was no easy matter to fathom what lay beneath it. There are a couple of roundelays, composed by a later poet, after the excellent rhythm of the Shichang Yue, which depict Pao Yu in a most adequate manner. The roundelays run as follows. To gloom and passion prone, without a rhyme, inane and mad-like was he many a time, his outer self, forsooth, fine may have been, but one wild, howling waste his mind within, addled his brain that nothing he could see, a dunce. To read essays so loath to be. Perverse in bearing, in temper wayward, for human censure he had no regard. When rich, wealth to enjoy he knew not how, when poor, to poverty he could not bow. Alas! What utter waste of lustrous grace! To state, to family what a disgrace! Of ne'er-do-wells below he was the prime, unfilial like him none up to this time. Ye lads, pampered with sumptuous fare and dress, beware! In this youth's footsteps do not press. But to proceed with our story. You have gone and changed your clothes, observed Dowager Lady Chia, before being introduced to the distant guest. Why don't you yet salute your cousin? Pao Yu had long ago become aware of the presence of a most beautiful young lady, who, he readily concluded, must be no other than the daughter of his aunt Lin. He hastened to advance up to her, and make his bow, and after their introduction, he resumed his seat, whence he minutely scrutinized her features, which he thought, so unlike those of all other girls. Her two arched eyebrows, thick as clustered smoke, bore a certain not very pronounced frowning wrinkle. She had a pair of eyes, which possessed a cheerful, and yet one would say, a sad expression, overflowing with sentiment. Her face showed the prints of sorrow stamped on her two dimpled cheeks. She was beautiful, but her whole frame was the prey of a hereditary disease. The tears in her eyes glistened like small specks. Her balmy breath was so gentle. She was as demure as a lovely flower reflected in the water. Her gait resembled a frail willow, agitated by the wind. Her heart, compared with that of Picon, had one more aperture of intelligence, while her ailment exceeded, in intensity, by 3 degrees the ailment of Shizu. Pao Yu, having concluded his scrutiny of her, put on a smile and said, "This cousin I have already seen in days gone by." "There you are again with your nonsense," exclaimed Lady Chia, sneeringly, "how could you have seen her before?" "Though I may not have seen her, ere this," observed Pao Yu with a smirk, "yet when I look at her face, it seems so familiar, and to my mind, it would appear as if we had been old acquaintances, just as if, in fact, we were now meeting after a long separation." "That will do. That will do," remarked Dowager Lady Chia, "such being the case, you'll be the more intimate." Pao Yu, thereupon, went up to Tai Yu, and taking a seat next to her, continued to look at her again with all intentness for a good long while. "Have you read any books, cousin?" he asked. "I haven't as yet," replied Tai Yu, "read any books, as I have only been to school for a year, all I know are simply a few characters." "What is your worthy name, cousin?" Pao Yu went on to ask, whereupon Tai Yu speedily told him her name. "Your style?" inquired Pao Yu, to which question Tai Yu replied, "I have no style." "I'll give you a style," suggested Pao Yu smilingly, "won't the double style pin pin, knitting brows, do very well?" "From what part of the standard books does that come?" Tan Chun hastily interposed. "It is stated in the thorough research into the state of creation from remote ages to the present day," Pao Yu went on to explain, "that, in the western quarter, there exists a stone, called Tai, black, which can be used, in lieu of ink, to blacken the eyebrows with. Besides, the eyebrows of this cousin taper in a way, as if they were contracted, so that the selection of these two characters is most appropriate, isn't it?" "This is just another plagiarism, I fear," observed Dan Chun, with an ironic smirk. "Exclusive of the 4 books, Pao Yu remarked smilingly, "the majority of works are plagiarized, and is it only I, perchance, who plagiarize? Have you got any jade or not?" he went on to inquire, addressing Tai Yu, to the discomfiture of all who could not make out what he meant. "It's because he has a jade himself," Tai Yu forthwith reasoned within her mind, "that he asks me whether I have one or not." "No, I haven't one," she replied. "That jade of yours is besides a rare object, and how could everyone have one?" As soon as Pao Yu heard this remark, he at once burst out in a fit of his raving complaint, and unclasping the gem, he dashed it disdainfully on the floor. "Rare object, indeed," he shouted, as he heaped invective on it, "it has no idea how to discriminate the excellent from the mean, among human beings, and do tell me, has it any perception or not? I too can do without this rubbish." All those, who stood below, were startled, and in a body they pressed forward, vying with each other as to who should pick up the gem. Dowager Lady Chia was so distressed that she clasped Pao Yu in her embrace. "You child of wrath," she exclaimed. "When you get into a passion, it's easy enough for you to beat and abuse people, but what makes you fling away that stem of life?" Pao Yu's face was covered with the traces of tears. "All my cousins here, senior as well as junior," he rejoined, as he sobbed, "have no gem, and if it's only I to have one, there's no fun in it, I maintain. And now comes this angelic sort of cousin, and she too has none, so that it's clear enough that it is no profitable thing." Dowager Lady Chia hastened to coax him. "This cousin of yours," she explained, "would, under former circumstances, have come here with a jade, and it's because your aunt felt unable, as she lay on her deathbed, to reconcile herself to the separation from your cousin, that in the absence of any remedy, she forthwith took the gem belonging to her daughter, along with her, in the grave, so that, in the first place, by the fulfillment of the rites of burying the living with the dead might be accomplished the filial piety of your cousin, and in the second place, that the spirit of your aunt might also, for the time being, use it to gratify the wish of gazing on your cousin. That's why she simply told you that she had no jade, for she couldn't very well have had any desire to give vent to self-praise. Now, how can you ever compare yourself with her? And don't you yet carefully and circumspectly put it on? Mind, your mother may come to know what you have done." As she uttered these words, She speedily took the jade over from the hand of the waiting maid, and she herself fastened it on for him. When Pao Yu heard this explanation, he indulged in reflection, but could not even then advance any further arguments. A nurse came at the moment and inquired about Tai Yu's quarters, and Dowager Lady Chia at once added, "Shift Pao Yu along with me, into the warm room of my suite of apartments, and put your mistress, Miss Lin, temporarily in the Green Gauze House, and when the rest of the winter is over, and repairs are taken in hand in spring in their rooms, an additional wing can be put up for her to take up her quarters in." "My dear ancestor," ventured Pao Yu, "the bed I occupy outside the Green Gauze House is very comfortable, and what need is there again for me to leave it and come and disturb your old ladyship's peace and quiet?" "Well, all right," observed Dowager Lady Chia, after some consideration, "but let each one of you have a nurse, as well as a waiting maid to attend on you. The other servants can remain in the outside rooms and keep night watch and be ready to answer any call." At an early hour, besides, Shi Feng had sent a servant round with a grey flowered curtain, embroidered coverlets and satin quilts and other such articles. Tai Yu had brought along with her only two servants. The one was her own nurse, Dame Wang, and the other was a young waiting maid of 16, whose name was called Xie Yan. Dowager Lady Chia, perceiving that Xie Yan was too youthful and quite a child in her manner, while Nurse Wang was, on the other hand, too aged, conjectured that Tai Yu would, in all her wants, not have things as she liked, so she detached two waiting maids, who were her own personal attendants, named Zhu Chuan and Ying Ko, and attached them to Tai Yu's service. Just as had Ying Chun and the other girls, each one of whom had besides the wet nurses of their youth, four other nurses to advise and direct them, and exclusive of two personal maids to look after their dress and toilette, four or five additional young maids to do the washing and sweeping of the rooms and the running about backwards and forwards on errands. Nurse Wang, Zhu Chuan and other girls entered at once upon their attendance on Tai Yu in the Green Gauze rooms, while Pao Yu's wet nurse, Dame Li, together with an elderly waiting maid, called Shi Zhen, were on duty in the room with the large bed. This Shi Zhen had also been, originally, one of Dowager Lady Chia's servant girls. Her name was in days gone by, Chen Chu. As her venerable ladyship, in her tender love for Pao Yu, had feared that Pao Yu's servant girls were not equal to their duties, she readily handed her to Pao Yu, as she had hitherto had experience of how sincere and considerate she was at heart. Pao Yu, knowing that her surname was at one time Hua, and having once seen in some verses of an ancient poet, the line "the fragrance of flowers wafts itself into man," lost no time in explaining the fact to Dowager Lady Chia, who at once changed her name into Shi Zhen. This Shi Zhen had several simple traits. While in attendance upon Dowager Lady Chia, in her heart and her eyes there was no one but her venerable ladyship, and her alone, and now in her attendance upon Pao Yu, her heart and her eyes were again full of Pao Yu, and him alone. But as Pao Yu was of a perverse temperament and did not heed her repeated injunctions, she felt at heart exceedingly grieved. At night, after Nurse Li had fallen asleep, seeing that in the inner chambers, Tai Yu, Ying Ko and the others had not as yet retired to rest, she disrobed herself, and with gentle step walked in. "How is it, miss," she inquired smiling, "that you have not turned in as yet?" Tai Yu at once put on a smile. "Sit down, sister," she rejoined, pressing her to take a seat. Shi Zhen sat on the edge of the bed. "Miss Lin," interposed Ying Ko smirkingly, "has been here in an awful state of mind. She has cried so to herself, that her eyes were flooded, as soon as she dried her tears. 'It's only today that I've come,' she said, 'and I've already been the cause of the outbreak of your young master's failing. Now had he broken the jade, as he hurled it on the ground, wouldn't it have been my fault? Hence it was that she was so wounded at heart, that I had all the trouble in the world, before I could appease her." "Desist at once, miss. Don't go on like this," Shi Zhen advised her. "There will, I fear, in the future, happen things far more strange and ridiculous than this, and if you allow yourself to be wounded and affected to such a degree by a conduct such as his, you will, I apprehend, suffer endless wounds and anguish, so be quick and dispel this oversensitive nature." "What you sisters advise me," replied Tai Yu, "I shall bear in mind, and it will be all right." They had another chat, which lasted for some time, before they at length retired to rest for the night. The next day, she and her cousins got up at an early hour and went over to pay their respects to Dowager Lady Chia, after which upon coming to Madame Wang's apartments, they happened to find Madame Wang and Shi Feng together, opening the letters which had arrived from Qin Ling. There were also in the room two married women, who had been sent from Madame Wang's elder brother's wife's house to deliver a message. Tai Yu was, it is true, not aware of what was up, But Tan Chan and the others knew that they were discussing the son of her mother's sister, married in the Xie family, in the city of Qinling, a cousin of theirs, Xie Pan, who relying upon his wealth and influence had, by assaulting a man, committed homicide, and who was now to be tried in the court of the Yingtian prefecture. Her maternal uncle, Wang Zutang, had now, on the receipt of the tidings, dispatched messengers to bring over the news to the Chia family. But the next chapter will explain what was the ultimate issue of the wish entertained in this mansion to send for the Xie family to come to the capital. Chapter 4. An ill-fated girl happens to meet an ill-fated young man. The Hulu Bonds adjudicates the Hulu case. Tai Yu, for we shall now return to our story, having come, along with her cousin to Madame Wang's apartments, found Madame Wang discussing certain domestic occurrences with the messengers, who had arrived from her elder brother's wife's home, and conversing also about the case of homicide, in which the family of her mother's sister had become involved, and other such relevant topics. Perceiving how pressing and perplexing were the matters in which Madame Wang was engaged, the young ladies promptly left her apartments, and came over to the rooms of their widow sister-in-law, Mrs. Li. This Mrs. Li had originally been the spouse of Chia Chu. Although Chu had died at an early age, he had the good fortune of leaving behind him a son, to whom the name of Chi Lan was given. He was, at this period, just in his fifth year, and had already entered school, and applied himself to books. This Mrs. Li was also the daughter of an official of note in Qinling. Her father's name was Li Shucheng, who had, at one time, been imperial libationer. Among his kindred, men as well as women had all devoted themselves to poetry and letters, but ever since Li Shucheng continued the line of succession, he readily asserted that the absence of literary attainments in his daughter was indeed a virtue, so that it soon came about that she did not apply herself in real earnest to learning, with the result that all she studied were some parts of the four books for women, and the memoirs of excellent women, that all she read did not extend beyond a limited number of characters, and that all she committed to memory were the examples of these few worthy female characters of dynasties of yore, while she attached special importance to spinning and female handiwork. To this reason is to be assigned the name selected for her, of Li Wan, Li, the weaver, and the style of Kung Tsai, palace seamstress. Hence it was that, though this Li Wan still continued, after the loss of her mate, while she was as yet in the spring of her life, to live amidst affluence and luxury, she nevertheless resembled in every respect a block of rotten wood or dead ashes. She had no inclination whatsoever to inquire after anything or to listen to anything, while her sole and exclusive thought was to wait upon her relatives and educate her son, and, in addition to this, to teach her young sisters-in-law to do needlework and to read aloud. Tai Yu was, it is true, at this period living as a guest in the Chia mansion, where she certainly had the several young ladies to associate with her, but, outside her aged father, she thought, there was really no need for her to extend affection to any of the rest. But we will now speak of Chia Yu Tsun. Having obtained the appointment of prefect of Yingtian, he had no sooner arrived at his post than a charge of manslaughter was laid before his court. This had arisen from some rivalry between two parties in the purchase of a slave girl, either of whom would not yield his right, with the result that a serious assault occurred, which ended in homicide. Yu Tsun had, with all promptitude, the servants of the plaintiffs brought before him, and subjected them to an examination. The victim of the assault, the plaintiffs deposed, was your servant's master. Having on a certain day, purchased a servant girl, she unexpectedly turned out to be a girl who had been carried away and sold by a kidnapper. This kidnapper had, first of all, got hold of our family's money, and our master had given out that he would on the third day, which was a propitious day, take her over into the house, but this kidnapper stealthily sold her over again to the Xie family. When we came to know of this, we went in search of the seller to lay hold of him, and bring back the girl by force. But the Xie party has been all along the bully of Qinling, full of confidence in his wealth, full of presumption.